I'd like to welcome you to the Board of Supervisors meeting March 23rd. For those of you who are standing up, there are seats in here. I would appreciate if you would try to find some seats and not block the doors. It would be very much appreciated. With that, if you would please with me stand and have a Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So help us.
Okay. With that, then, we will go into our presentation calendar.
Move approval.
Moved by Mr. Asajian, seconded by Ms. Bianchi. Roll call, please.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mrs. Pinard?
Aye.
Mr. Ryan?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
I'm not used to voting last. I got to get used to that. With that, then, we have item A1, and Mr. Asajian, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Patricia Harris and Alice Thorpe will come to the podium. There you are.
Hi.
Thank you. This is a resolution honoring Community Counseling Center upon its 35th anniversary in San Luis Obispo County. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas Community Counseling Center, formerly known as Family Service Center, a private nonprofit agency, was founded on August 27, 1968, and is proud of its long and innovative history in San Luis Obispo County. And whereas Community Counseling Center is one of the primary providers of mental health services in San Luis Obispo and has had its doors open to the public continuously for 35 years. And whereas Community Counseling Center has been a leader in establishing community programs, including hotline and emergency phone service, warm line, a parenting advice phone service, and the Latino Mental Health Program, which provides counseling and mental health services in Spanish to the bilingual, bicultural residents of San Luis Obispo County. Whereas Community Counseling Center has provided counseling at the county jail for inmates and in the Safe Schools Project for at-risk youth, and has sponsored numerous classes and workshops over the years, including child abuse prevention, family dynamics, and preventive mental health workshops. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby honor Community Counseling Center upon its 35th anniversary and extends their appreciation to the volunteers and staff for their dedication and community service. Would you please come forward and accept the resolution? If you would like to say a word, you're welcome.
I'd just like to thank you for your support. I want to thank you on behalf of our hardworking board of directors and our staff and our really wonderful team. All of our therapists are volunteer, and they give thousands of hours every year. So we appreciate that. We appreciate your recognition, and we're looking forward to the next 35 years. Thanks.
Thanks for your efforts.
With that and no other comments, then we will go into our public comment time period this morning. Again, to remind you to fill out a request to speak form and remind you that you have 3 minutes to make your presentation. This is on any item not on the agenda. First item, first person is Brad Brown, followed by Reverend C. Hyde.
Brad Brown. Cayucas. Public access television is run by a public group. Education access television is run by the Office of Education. Government access is run by a private for-profit business. I was surprised and saddened that you have abrogated your duties and made a gift of this government asset. Charter Cable has stated that they have no control over the government channel, and so you have set up a small business monopoly using government assets. Not only that, but according to the county's administrative office, you, the board, have given up oversight for the channel. There's no accountability. You have no oversight, no control over your own government access channel. I am incredulous. I am speechless.
Continue.
I am.
Brown, I would ask you please to continue.
I am continuing.
I know you have 3 minutes, but we...
I have 3 minutes, and speech should not be determined by the board. I am continuing. Thank you.
Reverend C. Height, followed by Rochelle Becker.
I'm Reverend C. Height. I'm here to report to the taxpayer as promised. Self-audit for the year 2003. I self-audit as the test case presented to the county in 1998, and because this board has limited the auditability of its failing social services by removing its chief financial advisor. As we review the year 2003, we will gain insight into the former policies and practices of the County of San Luis Obispo, and we may ask these questions. Do we have current and significant failure in this county? Failure found in a reported public health crisis, a reported public housing crisis, and now a reported crisis in essential services, exposing critical and unmet need. What vulnerable citizens are at greatest risk, and does this county's performance failure stigmatize, disadvantage, and discriminate against select citizens, the protected class of people, elders, at-risk youth, and the disabled? How do less profitable counties manage and guarantee their funds with the lack of secure income found in tourism and confinement? Is the County of San Luis Obispo unable or unwilling to meet the terms for which it receives state and federal tax dollars? How may such failure be circumvented? Have employees representing the county chosen to use their time and resources for stability and prevention, for the prevention of failure and further expense to the taxpayer? Or has time and resources been used for the limitation of upward mobility, independence, and the discouragement of success? This community and its taxpayer is obviously dissatisfied with business as usual and what has transpired under the current supervision of this board. We have opportunity for healthy and positive change. Could the tax dollar have been more efficiently spent, and would the community benefit from a reasonable adjustment to current practices? Will employees receiving county, state, and federal funds as county providers now be encouraged to make such positive adjustments? As I present the citizen self-audit, I will continue to question, has the County of San Luis Obispo used its county tax dollars to provide remedy and solutions or to create unmet need? Does unmet need and human failure bring profit to this county and at the expense to the taxpayer's state and federal tax dollar? Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to the next speaker, I need to remind people to clear the doorways. There's seats in here that if you can find them, please do that. We need to keep those doors open. And then Jill Bolster-White, were you on consent calendar? There's two items, mental health, or are you public comment?
Public comment.
Thank you. With that, then we'll go to Rochelle Becker, followed by Klaus Schumann.
My name is Rochelle Becker, and I represent the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. 25 years ago this week, an accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant caught the world's attention. A radioactive release at a U.S. commercial nuclear reactor became a reality and devastated the economy of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Plants such as Diablo Canyon, some with technology as old as Three Mile Island, were eventually granted controversial licenses with very little public confidence. Yesterday, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensed an expanded high-level radioactive waste dump on our coast without allowing public, county, or state evidence on increasing security at the site. Once again, the NRC has eroded public confidence. However, this is a legal error and will be considered by the Ninth Circuit Court in the very near future. Yesterday's license decision by the NRC showed no regard for the safety of this community, who will be forced to live with an inadequately reviewed security plan. In fact, it is the height of irresponsibility for the NRC to tell this county, tell those who must be the first responders, that they have no right to address issues of terrorism, acts of malice and insanity, especially in a post-9/11 world. The Mothers for Peace thank the Board of Supervisors for standing up for safety and the economic welfare of county residents, for supporting the Mothers for Peace appeal, and for demanding that public input, expert testimony, and the expertise of county responders is included in full evidentiary hearings. Our community and our state deserved to have these questions resolved before a license was granted to store additional tons of nuclear waste on our precious and priceless coastal zone. But the process is just beginning, and we invite others to join us. Information on the issues before the Ninth Circuit Court and how to join our efforts can be found on our website, www.mothersforpeace.org. And again, supervisors, thank you very much.
Thank you. Excuse me, folks, but we would appreciate if you did not do that. Klaus Schumann, followed by Fred Frank.
Good morning. Mr. Scheer, members of the board, my name is Klaus Schumann. I live in Paso Robles, and I represent the 2,700 county residents who are members of the San Luis Obispo Green Party. We would also like to say thank you to those supervisors who voted for the amicus brief. It is a right and responsible thing to do. PG&E calls this high-level radioactive waste spent or used or depleted fuel. We call it what it is: a deadly concoction of more than 200 highly radioactive and highly dangerous radioisotopes. In fact, spent fuel is 1 million times more radioactive than fresh fuel. How dangerous is it? Well, let's assume this podium here is made of spent fuel, which just came out of the reactor. I would have received a lethal dose of radiation before I could have wished you good morning. The folks here in the back seats or along the walls at the auditorium would have had to wait a few seconds longer for the privilege. Even after a couple of years of cooling underwater, spent fuel would still give me that lethal dose within seconds. And for the folks out here in the back seats, perhaps a minute. Spent fuel simply is the most radioactive substance on Earth. Even worse, it lasts for a long, long time. According to the NRC, it has to be isolated from the environment for a minimum of 10,000 years. That's 500 human generations. Many independent experts say for 1 million years or even longer. For a quarter million years, sorry. Each of the 200 highly radioactive isotopes presents its own set of problems. But in the context of terrorism, earthquakes, or accidents, clearly the most damaging is one called cesium-137. It's truly hideous because of three qualities. First, cesium-137 is the most abundant isotope in Diablo's waste. It accounts for about 21% of the total amount of radioactivity in 10-year-old spent fuel. Second, cesium-137 is a powerful gamma ray emitter inducing cancers in humans and accumulating in the food chain. And third, cesium-137 gets easily airborne in explosions or fires. The prevailing winds will then disperse it over vast areas, contaminating the soil, requiring a permanent evacuation of the affected areas for 300 to 600 years. And all this is because of this.
I would ask that you not do that.
Some people are
allergic to a clause. It is talcum powder, and he's trying. I have his speech here, and that's why we're stopping this. I understand what you try to do, but please do not.
Well, it has the consistency of talcum powder. It first would boil out in fires as a gas.
You need to get back to the microphone, please.
Cesium-137, what in explosions or fires first come out as a gas and then condenses when it's cooling off into the consistency of talcum powder. And that is what I brought it here for, to demonstrate how easily this, if I just put a little bit on my hand, clap the hands, it would go into the room.
I thank you.
Very easily.
I thank you, Klaus, but I think there's going to be some issues with that would be make some people very nervous. So,
thank you for giving me the time to explain it in words.
Yes.
It would have been a great demonstration, but.
Thanks, Klaus.
Fred Frank. Did I do that right? Yeah, Fred Frank, followed by Betty Windholz.
My name is Fred Frank, and I, too, would like to echo Rochelle Becker's thank you for supporting the legal action to require the NRC to have full public hearings on this very, very important issue. Coming up next month, your board will be making probably the most important decision that any board has ever made in this county. And I would like to suggest that we have only one opportunity to deal with this issue, and I hope that you take it quite seriously. I'm representing the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility today, and I'd like to demonstrate and make an audio demonstration of how much of this deadly radioactive material that is being contemplated to be stored in our county. Here's a little brochure you'd like to see for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. What I'd like to do is use BBs to demonstrate how much nuclear material, high-level, deadly waste will be stored there. And what I'm going to do is compare this to the long-term radiation that was released by the Hiroshima atomic bomb. Now, it should be recognized that the material that's stored out there is not concentrated enough to cause a nuclear explosion. However, it could be dispersed by many means, and it should recognize that we're dealing with a huge number of radioactive tons, around 3,000 tons. But this audio demonstration just gives you a little feel as to how much there is. This first BB will represent one atomic bomb. Now I'll demonstrate what was originally licensed for storage. This represents the long-term radiation from one bomb. The plans are to store 9 times what I dumped into the bucket. So you can see that we're talking about a huge amount of highly radioactive, deadly waste. Thank you.
Betty Winholt, followed by Eric Greening.
I have a couple of pictures I'd like to put on the overhead. Is there a way to do that?
It's going to take a few minutes till you make your presentation. I would appreciate it if you'd let us know ahead of time. It would have been much easier.
I did. My name is Betty Winholtz. I'm a member of the City Council in Morro Bay. However, I'm speaking for my constituents today and some of those in Los Osos who value our natural setting on the coast. What I am bringing to your attention today is what the Department of Parks and Recreation, locally known as State Parks, is doing over in our part of the county. They have a permit from this, from your jurisdiction, from the county, a 10-year permit to cut trees inside of state parks. This permit allows them to keep eucalyptus groves confined so they don't spread, because one of their mandates is to not proliferate what they consider a foreign species. To do that, they would cut things that are the size of your arm, 2, 4, 6 inches. However, there's a grove of trees, 24 trees, that you can see in this picture, up on off of South Bay Boulevard and Turi Road, for those of you who travel along there daily. And what they have done to get around this permit is to girdle the trees. And I just discovered this last week and went up and took pictures. And for those who don't know, girdling is to cut several inches into the trunk, a complete circle, so the tree dies slowly over time. This was done at the end of last year. The bottom picture up here shows a tree that survived that, and they have gone back and stuck poison into it so it will die. So the way they have gotten around their permit, which is to keep a grove confined, is to wipe out this grove. And for those who drive South Bay Boulevard, you will be noticing lately how the grove has turned gray and is now almost dead. Another location where they are doing a similar task is behind the Los Osos Middle School. And they have just been given the responsibility for part of a green belt piece of property, part of the Los Osos green belt. But what they have done here with these trees, and these trees are anywhere from 3 to 5 feet in diameter, okay? They're like 15, 16 feet in circumference. And they've gone in, and you can see the holes where they've stuck in the poison to kill the trees off. Now, this is a row of 75 trees. I've counted them myself, and half of them have literally been cut, and the other half have been poisoned. I question whether this is part of the permit and what was county interpreted as what would be happening. So what I'm asking is that at the least that you would ask there be a hold on this permit until this can be verified and see if they are following their permit, and at the most that this 10-year plan be having to give you details of what their intent is, because I don't think it's in like-mindedness of what the community is expecting or wanting. And so I'm asking you to take some action. Thank you.
Thank you. And I apologize. I didn't know that you had asked ahead of time. Eric Greening, followed by, is it Rick Keller? Yeah. Kelly? I assume you want to do public comment.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I totally support the words of Rochelle Becker, Klaus Schumann, and Fred Frank. I do thank you, Supervisor Ovett, for stopping the release of the talcum powder in this room, however, because I think it is important to maintain a real sensitivity to the access issues of environmentally sensitive and allergic people, and particularly on a day such as this, when there will be a hearing on a mosquito abatement district that is of particular importance to that community.
It's also, we have a whole lot of public health officials here looking for white powder.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't want to bring that up, but go ahead.
I did not bring any white powder of any kind for you. In that connection, I did want to ask, in the past, it has been a practice to accommodate by telephone connection people who wish to testify on items of concern to them who would have a sensitivity problem with the possibility of people wearing fragrances in this room, and we were recently told that that could not be continued. I would like to ask once again if it, first of all, why this can't be continued, and second of all, why an exception can't be made today, since the issue D1 is of particular importance to chemically sensitive people. And I would hope to have this answered on the record at the end of public comment, one way or another, either that the telephone connections will be made available so that we have real access for the chemically challenged people, the environmentally ill people, or whether that access cannot be provided, and if not, why not? But to go back to my first point, I am totally in support of the comments of the three speakers on the Diablo issue. I, too, would very much like to thank your board for trying to push the envelope on our coastal development permit, and again would like to repeat my plea that when push comes to shove, which is rapidly doing so, you strongly consider 10th Amendment litigation to restore to the states and the people a right which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Congress never had any right to give away, that of protecting our own safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Rick Kell, followed by Jill Bolster-White.
Good morning, Supervisors. My name is Rick Keller. I'm here to say thank you for the support for the Mothers for Peace and the Diablo appeal issue. One thing I think needs to be clarified, there's a misconception that we are trying to put PG&E out of business and take revenue away from the county. And that's, at least in my opinion, not anywhere of the sort. We want PG&E to be here. I look forward to getting my bills on a monthly basis. I just wish that it had come from perhaps a tidal power or wind power or even cogen, just so that for the benefit of the people working at PG&E, their health hazard, and ours, that it came from a cleaner source. Thank you.
Thank you. Jill Bolster-White.
Hello. Jill Bolster-White from Transitions Mental Health Association. I wanted to come and thank the Board of Supervisors, and particularly Supervisor Bianchi, for her leadership on the Mental Health Criminal Justice Task Force. The work has been really impressive and, I think, fruitful. I'm really delighted to see the formation of the Mental Health Court and increased crisis intervention training for law enforcement. So I really just wanted to appreciate your leadership on that and hope that you all and the CAO and the administration will work with the Mental Health Department and my agency to maintain a core set of services so those folks can be referred out to programs, because I know a lot of those are on the list to be cut in this next year's budget. So once again, I want to thank you for your help and leadership and see what we can do to keep some services going for those folks.
You can come anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jill. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak at public comment? Pam, are you coming up here? You know the rules. You've been standing back there for a long time.
I know, but I had so much on my mind.
You were blocking the door, too.
Thank you. Well, it's a good thing I came up then.
Just being observant.
Good morning. My name is Pam Hetherington, and I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo. And I, too, want to thank the board for sticking up for the community when it comes to Diablo Canyon. But I am a little dismayed about the talcum powder demonstration. I mean, we have a lot to worry about in this day and age, but we also cannot lose sight of the devastation that can be caused by Diablo Canyon. And I agree with Eric about letting loose any fragrances in here that might offend somebody, but I also think it's vitally important that you don't lose sight of the fact that if that talcum powder would have been let loose in this room this morning, the same thing could happen at PG&E. Thank you.
With that, we'll close public comment. Your public comment, or that's not? Okay, we'll close public comment and go to the next agenda item. It is public comment. Might as well come to the microphone, ma'am. I would appreciate, though, if you would put these in ahead of time so that we can...
I'm sorry. I thought there would be more comment.
No. Marian Mello?
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, your primary responsibility is the health and safety of San Luis Obispo County residents. And the greatest threat to our residents is the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant and the proposed storage of even more deadly nuclear waste. And I also would like to thank your board for actions you have taken in the past to address your responsibility. It's deeply appreciated. And as well, when it is before you again next month, please remember all of the people in this county and fulfill your responsibility to them. Nothing could be more important that you will ever do. Deep appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will now close public comment, and we will now go to the second part of our presentation calendar today, which is presentations of employee service recognition and Richard Greek and Trish Stampler. Mr. Greek.
Thank you very much, Chairman Ovitt, members of the board, Richard Greek, County Personnel Director. I'm delighted to be here and assist you in your recognition of county employees for their years of service. These are the folks that are providing that and ensuring that we fulfill the county's mission and vision, and they have dedicated a significant part of their life in meeting those goals that relate to the mission and vision. They individually and collectively represent the history and foundation and future of the county service delivery systems. And so without any additional ado, we'll begin the recognition first with the staff that helped put this together, which is Glenn Estrada from Risk Management, Trish Stamper from Personnel, and of course, a covey of other folk. What I will ask everyone to do then is for the 20-year recipients, when I call your name and department, please come forward. Trish Stamper will give you your pen, and if you'll stand in front of us here as a group, when we're completed, we'll give you a big round of applause. So starting on the 20 years, Gloria Honley from Child Support Services.
Again, I'll repeat what Richard said. If you would hold your applause to the end, it would make it much easier. Thank you.
But we appreciate the enthusiasm. Elaine Lewis was not able to, from Child Support Services, was not able to be here this morning. Carol Chapman, Child Support Services. Cindy Marie Absey from the District Attorney. Hopefully I got the last name correct. Robert Miller from Information Technology. Deborah Klosinski from the library. Only close? Oh, no. Cammie Griffin, Planning and Building.
Watch out for this one. That's why we held the applause.
And Donna Phelan from Probation. And now that warm round of applause, please. Okay, we'll now move to the 25-year recipients. I'd like to remind department heads, since they're going to be making brief statements, that brief is 3 minutes or less. And I would ask that the department heads come to the left podium and the employee will go to the right podium. I don't know if that's stage right or stage left. So the right podium's over there, the left podium's here. So we'll start with the district attorney's office, and if Lee Kogan will come forward and Dan Hilford.
Good morning. I'm Dan Hilford, Assistant District Attorney, and I have the honor and privilege to be able to present a 25-year award to Lee Kogan. Lee began the practice of law in the state of Illinois in July of 1964. Lee served with the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office with distinction from July of 1969 until joining the San Luis Obispo County District Attorney's Office in April of 1979. Lee was assigned to the Economic Crime Unit, which was created in December of 1980, supervising all fraud and consumer complaints based on his experience with the major fraud unit in the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. Lee was one of the first three felony team leaders when our superior court in this county went to felony vertical prosecution structure. Lee served as a filing deputy district attorney, reviewing and processing voluminous requests for complaints from all county agencies, and worked many years as a municipal court trial deputy district attorney. Lee was assigned to the Family Support Division for approximately 2 years, beginning in 1985, following now DA Jerry Shea, who had been promoted to chief deputy district attorney at that time. And Lee has recently been assigned to the criminal prosecution of failure to pay support cases as a deputy DA assigned to the Department of Child Support Services. Lee also has had the distinction of being the president of the Government Attorneys Union for about 20 years. Lee has been a tenacious and a wonderful prosecutor, and I'm very honored and pleased to be able to present this 25-year award. Congratulations, Lee.
Thank you. I have very little to say other than thank you. It's been a great ride, and since 1964, that's been a long time to be a lawyer, but I've enjoyed every minute of it, and it's been especially a pleasure to serve the people of this county and this board. I've enjoyed almost every minute of it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next, I would like Rick Conradi to come forward from the District Attorney's Office.
I'm Dan Hilford, Assistant District Attorney, and once again, I'm very pleased and honored to be able to present this 25-year award to Rick Conradi. Rick joined the Ontario Police Department in 1976 and worked there from 1976 to 1979 as a patrolman. Thereafter, Rick joined the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Department as a sheriff's deputy in 1979, and he was promoted to a detective position in 1982. Rick served approximately 8 years in the Narcotics Task Force in the County of San Luis Obispo with distinction. Rick joined the District Attorney's Office as a District Attorney Investigator in 1994. Rick has been primarily assigned to the Street Gang and Intelligence Unit, and he is currently assigned to gangs, intelligence, and major crimes. Rick has developed expertise in gangs, working with the Countywide Gang Task Force. Rick has investigated numerous high-profile gang-related murders and other gang-related major crimes. Rick receives consistent praise from attorneys for his felony trial work. Rick is highly regarded by his peers for his expertise in gangs, intelligence, and major crimes. Rick is a tenacious investigator with an excellent sense of investigative techniques and people skills, which enables him to have a high success rate in successful arrests and prosecutions. And I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate Rick for his 25 years as a county employee and as a fine DA investigator. Thank you, Rick.
I even have less to say than Lee. Thank you very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
We'll next move to the library. I'd ask that Kristen Barnhart come forward and Brian Reynolds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Richard, and members of the audience. Librarians are special people. You probably heard the joke. They never die. They just get overdue.
No, I hadn't heard that one.
It's an old, old one. I'm so honored that you're laughing, too. It makes me feel better. I'm sure Kristen does, too. Kristen is one of our veteran staffers. More than 25 years ago, on January 2nd, 1979, she left a library position in the Bay Area to become a library assistant in the Cayucas and Cambria branch libraries. During that time, Kristen has seen many changes occur in library service, for example, moving from card to computer catalogs. From day one, Kristen has provided exemplary service to her customers and established lasting friendships, especially with children and their parents. She served as the branch manager at Cambria for many years before beginning new responsibilities in Morro Bay and now in San Luis Obispo. Kristen is a gifted storyteller and has honed her skills not only in the library, but also at women's retreats, workshops, and at the Live Oak Music Festival. Kristen obviously loves her job and improves her skills by reading book reviews, conducting class visits, plus overseeing and motivating volunteers. Today, Kristen Barnhart is a children's librarian whose Thursday morning story time for parents and toddlers attracts at least 60 people per week to the San Luis Obispo City Library. Teenagers welcome her suggestions as well, since Kristen is always able to hand a person just the right book. We hope you will join us in congratulating Kristen on her 25th anniversary of providing superior library service to the public.
Hi, Shirley. She remembers when I was just a sweet young thing showing up on the coast, wondering, gee, the job description at this interview sounds an awful lot like I'm going to be the only one in the library. And not only that, there were two of them. And I really hadn't heard of such a thing. But I didn't exactly leave my Bay Area position voluntarily. Some of you may remember Proposition 13, which did close them down. And as they say, every door that shuts, a window opens. If that hadn't have happened, I wouldn't have been able to have joined my family here in San Luis Obispo, watched my nephews grow up, become a real-life children's librarian, and watch your children grow up. Yesterday I had a child in who is like 35 now. I remember him learning to write his name. So it's a very, very high honor to be able to be here and have that consistency with our children and our community, because it's not your board, it's our board, and we thank you for your support.
Next, we'll move to county personnel. Brenda Smythe is out of state, but I'd like to make a couple quick comments. She is a longstanding member of our technical division team. Brenda is a key resource for using our old systems with innovation to help personnel meet the contemporary requirements of recruiting and testing. That is a fancy way of saying she uses baling wire and bubble gum effectively. She also ably assists personnel as we evaluate and measure performance and is assisting in setting the stage for the new systems and processes we're putting in place, and we'll have a celebration upon her return. The next department is Pension Trust. Andrea Paley is also not present, but as a trustee on behalf of the San Luis Obispo County Pension Trust, I'd just like to note that we certainly, and I think she's touched every county employee, appreciate her 25 years. I'd like to acknowledge that she does exceptional work delivering the benefits programs for the Pension Trust, and she does, in fact, support every one of us as we look at our future and touches us in a positive way. And I'm sure there will be a celebration in Andrea's near future, too. I'd next like to visit Planning and Building and ask that Bob Morenza come forward and Vic Holanda.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I am Vic Holanda, the Director of Planning and Building, and it's a pleasure to provide remarks this morning on behalf of Bob Morenza's 25 years. Bob, who is a licensed architect, started his career with the county and in the General Services Department 25 years ago in 1979 as an architectural draftsman. Incidentally, he has a degree in architecture from Cal Poly. He was one of the brighter ones in our department who chose to attend a higher institutional learning close to state colleges like San Diego State. When he started his career with the county in 1979, Jerry Brown was governor and Jimmy Carter was president. And incidentally, the newest city planning commissioner for the city of San Luis Obispo, who is from our department, Andrea Miller, was born that year. First class stamp was only cost 15 cents, and incidentally, back then, you could afford to buy a house here in San Luis Obispo. Through his dedicated and hard work, Bob was eventually promoted from draftsman to capital projects coordinator in general services. In this role, he was responsible for ensuring that county remodel projects, such as the County General Hospital and the Morro Bay Golf Club, were built correctly and on schedule. Back in those days, Bob was known for his tenacity of doing things right and on time. His unsympathetic approach to dispense with creative excuses from subcontractors established his reputation early on for knowing and doing things right. In 1985, he joined the Planning and Building Department as an architectural engineering assistant, and that was in our plan checking division. And this is where he continues to provide meaningful dialogue with contractors, architects, and homeowners on how to survive the rigors of construction plan review. Again, his exceptional diplomatic and persistent demeanor didn't go unnoticed because 3 years later in 88, Bob was promoted to Building Examiners 3. A few short years later in 1990, Bob was promoted to his current position as Supervising Building Plans Examiner. And this is where he and his colleagues have, over time, have collaborated on many innovative changes resulting in improved customer service, cost savings, and efficiencies. In fact, this past year, they were able to reduce plan checking time for residential projects from 12 weeks to 3 to 4 weeks, saving a considerable amount of money, not only for the applicant and builders, but also for the county. Last year alone, he and his staff reviewed and approved over 1,000 construction plans, amounting to over $250 million in valuation of construction projects. Bob is a leader and a mentor who continues to teach the fundamental skills of how to say no with diplomacy, and how to say yes with enthusiasm. He consistently emphasizes three important principles of providing information to the public: accuracy, honesty, and reliability. Like many other extraordinary, talented, capable, and thoroughly committed county employees, Bob is probably not aware of just how much he is appreciated, but that's why we are here this morning, to acknowledge him and others and give him this well-deserved recognition as our way of saying thanks. Bob, congratulations on an astounding 25 years of dedicated county public service.
Last 25-year individual is from...
Well, I would like to thank everyone, the board, and the people that I work with, which have made these 25 years seem much shorter than they really are. Thank you very much.
And, Bob, I hope I didn't shorten those comments more than you had intended. Our last 25-year recipient is not present this morning, but I would like to let the probation department know that there will be a clock on the way for Claire Irene. We finally have three 30-year recipients. Chairman Ovitt, is going to initiate the discussion with a follow-up by the department head. The first two are from the county council's office, and I'd like to ask Wyatt Cash to come forward.
Okay.
Morning.
I got to change it. I do want Vic Alanda to stay, though. I think somebody from San Diego State would like to talk to you. And I don't know who that might be. Anyway, the next two gentlemen, if they follow the order that I was given, along with Mr. Lindholm, I'm going to call them the Gang of Three, because they all started basically from the district attorney's office and then moved into county council. And for those of you who've been around for that long a time period, remember that that was a kind of a interesting time period when we formed the county council's office. But anyway, Wyatt grew up in Taft, which we'll forgive you for. That's not a bad place, really. He's from Taft, yeah, and that's true. And graduated in high school and received a Bachelor of Science degree in Military Science and then went into the U.S. Air Force Academy. And then after serving the Air Force as a flight navigator, he earned his degree from the University of California, Davis, which, you know, is another state school. You know, I'm going to give you a bad time about that. After law school, Wyatt worked as a criminal prosecutor in San Diego County District Attorney's Office. He began work as district attorney in San Luis Obispo in 1974 and was promoted to assistant district attorney in 1979 in the DA's office. And Wyatt's widely respected for, and this is written by Jim Lindholm, I'll let you know. The other one, respected as a successful prosecutor who handled many of the county's most important criminal cases. And in 1981, Wyatt successfully made the transition from prosecutor to civil trial attorney when he joined the county council's office as deputy county counsel. He became chief deputy county counsel in 1977 and successfully served as distinction in this position ever since. As Chief Deputy, Wyatt has been in the position of being the Chief Litigation Troubleshooter, and over the years he successfully handled a number of major civil cases in many different areas of laws. His success as a trial lawyer has been due partly to his ability to cut through the complex problems and focus on the issues. Wyatt has always enjoyed facing challenges in the trial area of law, in the management of the county council offices, and as legal advisor to county clients. He has a broad range of experience ranging from labor law to grand jury law, and most recently advising the Assessment Appeals Board. Wyatt is a valuable resource to the San Luis Obispo County. His leadership in the county council's office has earned him the respect of the clients and his colleagues. It gives me great pleasure to recognize him for his dedication and service to the county for 30 years. And congratulations, Wyatt.
Before Wyatt responds to Chairman Ovid, I'm Jim Lindholm, County Council. I'd certainly second what Chairman Ovid had to say about Wyatt. Working with Wyatt as part of the County Council management team and having his support and friendship over the years has been one of the most enjoyable aspects of my job. And it's a pleasure for me to recognize Wyatt for his 30 years of dedicated and distinguished service to the county. And Wyatt, I look forward to working with you on new challenges in the future. Thank you and congratulations.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you, Chairman Ovid and board members, for this recognition. I really appreciate it. Obviously, after 30 years, there are a lot of highlights that you can pull out and look back on. But I think to distill it all down, it's been the people that I've worked with, and especially in the district attorney's office, Chris Money, who I worked for and with, and Jim Lindholm and Jack Crawford, both in the district attorney's office and in the county council's office. And they're all, to this day, valued friends of mine. Also, my colleagues over the years in the district attorney's office and the county council's office and the support staff, and especially my colleagues, some of whom are here in the audience today, just an outstanding, talented group of lawyers. And I think a lot of you appreciate that. I certainly do. And also our support staff, we have a great office. And I'm really grateful for that. Thank you again for this recognition.
Thank you, Wayne. Shirley has something to say.
No, I just wanted to comment that I met Wyatt in 1984 when I was first on the San Luis Obispo County Grand Jury. And at that time, I really learned to appreciate his expertise and learned to trust him very much. Thank you, Wyatt.
Thank you. Great.
Next, I would ask that Jack Crawford step forward, County Council's office.
Is Vic still here? Okay. Now, Jack was born in Texas. We're not going to hold him against because Wyatt came from Taft, so we got, you know, very basic people here. But he grew up in San Diego and earned his bachelor's degree in philosophy and history from Cal State San Diego. He's got his Juris Doctorate degree from the University of San Diego Law School. So now that we've plugged San Diego and Davis, we can continue on. But for 2 years prior to coming to San Luis Obispo, he was a trial lawyer for a multi-line insurance company. After joining the DA's office in 1974, Jack spent 3 successful years as a deputy district attorney. And in 1977, and this is the words of Jim, he was part of that very tumultuous creation of the county council's office. And if I can recall those days, that's a nice word. It was quite a hassle to get that started, but that's why I call him a gang of three. In the intervening years, in addition to helping manage the county council's office, Jack has provided legal representation to the county's very successful self-insurance program. In addition, he currently serves as a legal advisor to the state CSAC Excess Insurance Authority. Jack has always eagerly taken on challenges in new, unfamiliar areas in law, and it is difficult to think of any area in county council practice in which he has not become an expert. We keep moving you around, don't we? Anyway, the attorneys in the county council's office know that if they need to find a case 10 years old, the best way is to ask Jack. That's, you know. After the years, Jack has become recognized as the office mentor to many of the lawyers and future lawyers. Jack's outstanding service to the county has been characterized by his dedication to achieving the best results for his clients, and he has also been known for truly caring for people and helping them in a friendly way to resolve their legal problems. Along the way, while working many long hours with the county, he has found time to devote to the community. He has been an active scout leader for many years and recently has received the award of Silver Beaver, scouting's highest award, and that is a great honor. Jack comes to work every day with enthusiasm for a challenge of resolving every challenging, never the same legal problems. You write these pretty good, Jim. I got through that without stumbling. His leadership as part of the county's council's team has been a major factor in the success of the county council. He is a very valuable asset to the county, and it is a pleasure to recognize Jack for his outstanding service to the county. And I want to add to it that as long as I've known Jack and Wyatt, they've been in all kinds of different situations and all kinds of different challenges, and they have come through with flying colors. And Jack, congratulations.
Thank you. Before Jack speaks, I'm Jim Lindholm, County Council, and I certainly again would second the comments by Chairman Ovid. Jack's leadership as part of the County Council management team has been a major factor in the success of the County Council's office, and I am extremely grateful to Jack for his support, his dedication, his friendship over the past 30 years. It's unbelievable to say 30 years in many ways. I remember the day when Jack was just hired as a deputy DA. It seems almost like yesterday. It's a true pleasure to recognize Jack for his 30 years of outstanding service to the county, and I'm looking forward to working with Jack and together with Wyatt to facing the many challenges in the future. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jim. You know, I think it's been one of the greatest blessings in my life that I've been able to do 30 years of very interesting and challenging work, and I want to thank your board, your predecessor boards, for entrusting that work to me. I want to thank Jim Lindholm for his leadership and his wisdom and, you know, his steadfastness. I mean, we've been through a lot of tough times, and,
He's always displayed the trust in my judgment that I feel comes from true friendship. And I think that one of the things I'm most proud of is the staff that we've built, Wyatt and Jim and I. We've got one of the greatest staffs of county council deputies and paralegal people that you could find anywhere in the state. And I think of offices our size, we're recognized as being a superior county council's office. I want to thank your board for supporting us for these 30 years. Thank you very much.
That Susan Hobler come forward and Jeanette Pell.
There is no truth to the rumor that we just switched from an abacus to the 1620 key punch. Came up with.
No.
But 30 years is a long time, and there's been a lot of changes on that fourth floor. Susan Hobler began her career as the Office of Technical Services as a computer operator in February of 1974, and today she's the second longest term employee with the Information Technology Department and has 30 years of service in the county, and we congratulate you. During the tenure, she has seen a number of changes in department names, roles, titles, whatever, you know, equipment has changed. We don't worry about the fourth floor falling in anymore. Yeah. Susan has held these positions as Computer Systems Tech 2, Computer Systems Tech 3, Senior Computer Systems Technician, Data Processing Operation Manager, and today is IT's Operations Supervisor. Susan has filled this role for a number of years and is readily recognized by all of those who visit the fourth floor of the old courthouse. Her dedication to the customer satisfaction, personnel sacrifice, and knowledge make her an asset to ITD. Congratulations to you, Susan, and thank you for the years of the county, and we're looking forward to your future contributions. Thank you. I have fun with that because when I first became supervisor, I took a tour of the fourth floor, and they had a whole section that did nothing but punch in keys to cards to enter into computer. Technology has changed quite a bit. Do you want to?
Yes. I'm Jeanette Pell, the CIO of Information Technology Department. On behalf of the department and the County of San Luis Obispo, we'd like to thank Sue for 30 years of dedicated service. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Ovid is correct. We have seen a lot of changes up there. One of our large rooms at that time was set up just for data entry key punch. We still already have remaining some of our data entry operators, which is kind of nice. They progressed through the ranks and are moving up to computer operators. When I first came 30 years ago, I told my boss at that time that I would give him a year and a half for sure. Well, 30 years later, I guess couldn't figure out a better place to go than San Luis Obispo, and it's been an honor and a pleasure to work here for the county. We've had some wonderful people and some good times and a lot of changes, and I'm sure we'll continue to have changes and some good times also. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Greek. Fish. With that, then, we will now go into the consent calendar. You want to do it?
Sure.
All right. What we're going to do is we're going to take a 15-minute break. We'll be a little bit longer than that because we have something to do upstairs. We'll be back at 20 after the hour. Thank you for your indulgence. It takes me a long time to get up and down the elevator. With that, then, we'll go into the consent calendar. And this is the opportunity for people to speak on items on the consent calendar. And with that, we'll start with the, again, request to speak form. And you have 3 minutes to speak on items on the consent calendar. With that, we have Reverend C. Height. And we combine both items. Ms. Height, you have 3 minutes on both items, B7 and B16.
I'm Reverend C. Height. B7, request for approved memorandum on understanding of San Luis Obispo County Office of Education to provide mental health services. And I have a question. Who is that for? The referral agency for disabled services with social services. The disabled would have benefited from your support of social services, not financially undermining their ability to function. Disability awareness training, opportunity services, effective and timely referrals and notices would be an improvement over counseling to cope with the frustrations of being a disabled person in a county that is having a service, housing, and health crisis. The County of San Luis Obispo bases its budget on a significant amount of grants and funds designated for the socially, economically, mentally, and physically handicapped. These funds are based on federal and state of California grant monies, tax dollars, and do enable the county to provide equitable access to the provision of services, opportunity, and the right of way for all citizens. And it would be helpful, I think, for the disabled to not be stigmatized with a mental health classification because they have no services and they now must turn to mental health for counseling. And as we come to this board and we listen to what is being projected to the public, there is concerns that accepting mental health in this county may stigmatize a person, and that might not be in their best interest. Continuing on, I have concerns for what is being promoted in this county, and this truly frightened me, and this advocacy is for anime fans everywhere. This is on county website. Now, I'm reading through this, and not only does this stigmatize my family, it actually profiles me. I wear black. I'm an artist. I'm ordained, and I'm taking exception to quite a number of things in this information. The community is dedicated to stopping this kind of activity and hampering gangs activity. Well, on July 7th of 2002, I stood on Pismo State Beach after being mauled by a very wild puppy, and I stood there with a bamboo cane, which was my walking stick, and called to the aid of my disabled son, who was also my durable power of attorney and my acting and home support services worker. He was wearing black, and he's multicultural. And when I look through this, simply, we were profiled, and the officer that came to our aid decided to retire, and I ended up with rabies shots. We simply did not have the same opportunities for this to be handled to protect my health. And I believe that it's quite possible that the reason might be that information like this that's going out is quite possibly causing people to look at other people, what they're wearing. He happened to be wearing a red shirt that just clinched it, and it was a Cowboy Bebop anime shirt.
Ms. Height,
and
your 3 minutes are up.
Okay, thank you very much.
Robert Mueller, followed by Eric Greening.
My name is Robert Mueller. I have offices at 2050 Garfield Street, San Luis Obispo, and I'm a property owner in Oceano. I'm speaking to item B2 on the consent agenda and would actually ask the board if they would pull this item and have it for discussion. I think there were some questions of general services that I referred on my speaker slip that could be answered perhaps would influence my comments. Recently, in an action where the board was involved, my neighbor in Oceano was advised by county planners that he needed to remove 250-gallon barrels of fuel storage from his property, and it occurred, unfortunately, because I had made a comment to the county about how I was concerned about that storage so close to my property, and this is 250-gallon storages. We're looking at a $8,000 or 8,000-gallon above-ground fuel storage to be installed at the Oceano Airport, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. I believe that there's probably some review that should be taken by fire officials and included and attached to this proposal. It is my understanding that above-ground fuel storage is specifically not an allowable use within this zone. It certainly is within the neighborhood. I don't know whether there is a specific rule that excludes the airport from above-ground fuel storage rules in this vicinity, but I would ask that the board find out whether that would be correct. It's my reading of this letter of proposal. The county is using an enterprise fund that's generated by transportation taxes paid by all users of public transportation, specifically in the air travel system, to subsidize what is very much a private contractor who is in a business operation at the Oceano County Airport facility. And so I would ask the board whether there's a cost-benefit analysis for that. The count recently, at a public meeting in Oceano where the airport manager spoke, she stated that the Oceano Airport does not currently meet federal aviation minimum safety standards for a small airport. The county has accepted a grant of approximately $2 million in various proportions that, after the expenditure of this money, will not, according to the airport manager, change the fact that the Oceano Airport will not meet minimum safety standards for a small airport.
Thank you, Ms. Peter.
I had one other item. Could I?
You're allowed 3 minutes, and I'll see if we can get these questions asked for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Greening, followed by Joy Fitchie.
I'm Eric Greening, and this one is primarily a thank you, assuming you approve it. I'm speaking on item B20, which finally puts to rest the phase one of the periodic review of our local coastal plan. And these were supposedly the easy issues. We've had quite a bit of back and forth with the Coastal Commission, and moving forward on this acknowledges that we have received the Coastal Commission's modified language and are ready to move forward into the more difficult issues of Phase 2 and Phase 3. And I hope that we do, in fact, meet this milestone that's ahead of us. It must be done at this meeting, or the whole process with Phase 1 starts all over again. And we have plenty of work ahead of us on Phases 2 and Phase 3, and I hope that we move forward with the gracious intent to truly implement the Coastal Act in this county. I know we have a lot of dialogue and a lot of issues to work out, but if we move forward with the real intent of implementing the Coastal Act, we should be able to move through the other phases as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Joy Fitchue, followed by Jeff Kuiper, or Kupper.
Good morning, Joy Fitzhugh, San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau. And I wanted to first acknowledge that there's been a lot of work done by staff. They've worked with the ag community. They've worked with Ag Liaison Board. And there's been a lot of changes and compromise to what is B20 today, which is the first phase of the LCP. But I also want to let you know there's still two things that came back from Coastal Commission staff that I have discomfort with. I mean, it's not going to keep me up late nights with heartburn, but I think it's really something that you need to think about, and that is the alternatives analysis and some of the fallout consequences of that, and also the 100-foot setback in the rural areas from the outside edge of the riparian corridors.
Thank you. Jeff, this is Kuiper.
Yes, it's Kuiper. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jeff Kuiper from Environmental Defense Center in Santa Barbara. I'm here on behalf of Friends of the Ranchland. And I am here to urge you to follow staff's recommendation for item number B20, phase one of the LCP amendments. We are excited and thrilled that progress is finally being made on updating the county's coastal policies. As you know, this process began back in 1997 and has consumed valuable time and resources of coastal advocates, county staff, as well as Coastal Commission staff. We look forward to working with your staff again as we move forward with Phase 2 and the North Coast Area Plan update. Just as a side note, if the county decides not to approve the LCP amendments today, we are concerned that the county will miss its March 31st deadline that was imposed by the Coastal Commission, and that's just next week. As you recall, the Coastal Commission sent a letter to the county back in September outlining a list of priority LCP amendments and deadlines to complete these amendments. The Coastal Commission voted to send this letter in lieu of taking more aggressive action, such as sending a letter to the legislature, which is the Coastal Commission is actually required to do under the Coastal Act, but it decided not to. I'd be willing to bet that the commission will not look favorably upon the county if it misses this deadline. Third point I'd like to make, these Phase 1 LCP amendments are crucial to protect San Luis Obispo County's coastline and to bring the county's outdated coastal policies into compliance with the Coastal Act. For example, these amendments that hopefully you will approve today require the agricultural industry to comply with new policies regulating polluted runoff and require everybody to improve protections for ESHA and coastal access. Everyone should play by the same rules when it comes to coastal protection. Finally, we request that you approve these amendments in recognition of the huge compromise on the part of coastal advocates and the Coastal Commission. In 2001, the Coastal Commission approved the periodic review of the county's LCP, which included 165 recommended changes to the county's coastal policies to bring them into compliance with the Coastal Act. Phase one only addressed 30 of these recommendations. The Coastal Commission all along expressed grave concerns about the county's amendments, but in the end, it erred on the side of moving forward and only required a handful of amendments, and these are the amendments that are before you today. Many of the county's amendments still do not achieve compliance with the Coastal Act, but in the spirit of moving forward, we urge you to approve these amendments. So thank you again for your work on this matter, and we look forward to moving forward with phase two. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else who wish to speak on an item on a consent calendar? Pam Hetherington.
Good morning again. Pam Hetherington, Executive Director of the Environmental Center. I too want to encourage you to vote pass B20. It's a first step in a long journey of protecting our coast, and I know that each one of you realizes that the coastal areas bring in tourist dollars, clean tourist dollars, and that to champion the Coastal Act and protect those areas is part of a sound economy for San Luis Obispo. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment and bring it back to the board. Mr. Ryan, any items that you have? All right. Ms. Bianchi?
B9 is for comment and
Versagian.
I can comment on B2 if General Services want to share
that
thought.
Yeah, I've got four questions. Somebody from General Services. We'll have B2 then. Now, Ms. Pinard.
None other than mention.
Okay.
I do.
Let me.
I forgot one. I'd like to have just a staff response to B7.
Okay. Mr. Leib on B2.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the where we were told that we're out of whack, so to say, but that's why we're doing the widening of the runways to bring it up to code. And with today's standards, when you install a gas tank above ground, it has safety measures that comes with it. It has to be approved by EPCDN and environmental health. And it is more environmentally friendly to have above ground than underground, where you can detect leaks faster and take care of it faster. And I assume those are the reasons why we're installing above ground. And the usage will ring also generate some income for the airport operation. So for those are the would have been some of my response. I don't know if Mr. Leib want to add to that or not.
Thank you, Supervisor Sajjan, members of the board. Dwayne Leib, General Services Director. Lots of issues raised. You're absolutely correct. The current technology to replace underground fuel storage is above ground fuel storage, and as your board will recall, that is the standard we're using at a lot of our outlying fuel storage areas, specifically Santa Margarita Lake and Lopez Lake, just recently replaced above ground. Oceano is substandard, single wall construction. It has to come out of the ground. We've had fuel service there as long as there's been an airport. The current standard, which is very tightly controlled by state regulations and local regulations, is above ground storage. It would go in the same location as the existing storage, and it's interior of the airport inside the fence, fairly distant from local residences, but it goes through environmental review for approvals to take it out. It goes through environmental approvals to put it in.
And the state agency is the Water Quality Board that gets involved with underground.
Yes. Also, your comment about the concessionaire, as your board is aware, we don't have full-time staff at Oceano Airport. It is basically operated by a concessionaire, which was competitively chosen years ago. It's a very good arrangement for the county, and we would like to keep that going.
And the fuel has to be brought to the airplanes regardless if you have it on location or have a truck of 8,000 gallons drive to the location.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know if there was another issue. The safety issues.
There's some questions here, and possibly you want to maybe Klosher or somebody get with Mr. Mueller, but there's some of them that relate to the fire safety, and I'm sure that fire has gone through this in terms of
right.
What the requirements are.
Well, he also made some reference to the airport standards about meeting minimum standards. I'm really not sure what that's about, and Klosher should probably, as you suggest, meet with Mr. Mueller.
And this is the same, basically, the original contract, the work scope and everything's still the same. It hasn't been changed since we applied for the grant?
No, it has not.
Okay. What I could recommend, if you would, then see if you can get with Mr. Mueller before you go and maybe have him get with Klaus to answer some of his questions on that thing.
Sure will.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, then, we'll go to item B7, Ms. Bianchi.
Just a staff response to some of the comments made.
Thank you. Dale Wolf, Behavioral Health Director. The concern that I heard raised had to do with the stigmatizing of children who receive mental health services. And certainly we as staff are equally concerned that anybody, it's unfortunate that anyone is stigmatized for being treated for a mental disorder. On the other hand, we would not want to withhold services. And the state law requires, and our attention to the health and development of children requires that we do provide those services. And this item would allow one of those flips that you see in state and federal government funding that allows the Office of Education to provide us some of the reimbursement that we are otherwise not getting from the state for this service.
Thank you.
Thank you. B9?
No, I just wanted to thank the people who wrote to me. This is the pedestrian and bicycle way between Cayucas and Morro Bay, and I received several letters supporting this, and I just wanted to thank people who wrote.
Okay. Mr. Ryan, B20.
B20 is accepting an amendment to the local coastal plan, and they had a number of them here that we approved, sent up to the Coastal Commission, and it came back with recommended changes by the Coastal Commission. I talked with Farm Bureau yesterday. I talked with the Ag Task Force. Neither one of them have had time to actually go through the changes and see what they consist of. And in just going through this, there are many places that we had exempted some agricultural operations, and almost every place that I can find in here, they've eliminated any exemption of agricultural operations, which if we're going to keep a vibrant agricultural economy on the coast, we need to look at some of that. And I'd like to have the ag community take a look at this and come back with, after they've had a chance to really review it, come back and give us some written feedback on what they see here. So I'd like to have this continued for a couple weeks so they can have meetings of their organization.
Okay. Any other comments, Ms. Bianchi?
Yes, the comment was made by a member of the public that we, if we put this off for 2 weeks, we will not be meeting the March 31st deadline that the Coastal Commission established for us getting these back in. I'd like John Euphrat to respond to that. But with your response, the consideration that it took the Coastal Commission 8 months to get their review of these policies back to us, so is that March 31st deadline as set in concrete as some members of the public seem to think? And I have other comments I'd like to make.
Okay. John Euphrat, Department of Planning and Building Staff. The deadline that was referred to of March 31st is one that was established by the chair of the Coastal Commission, and they voted on it, I believe, unanimously, and sent it to our chair. And it does not, associated with it, have any monetary fines or penalties associated with it. It's more in the spirit of good faith. So I don't think the sky's going to fall if we don't meet it. However, you know, as a part of negotiating in good faith, we wanted to do our best to try and meet that deadline. I do want to point out, though, that this package, it's actually at a point now where we can no longer negotiate. It's really at that kind of uncomfortable stage of where it's all or nothing, and that the commission has taken, your board has taken your action previously on approving the amendment. The Coastal Commission took their action, which was to approve it with some modifications. And at that point in time, we can either accept the package with those modifications or we don't accept it. And so there were, I believe, at least three sections where we had proposed that the agricultural industry be, that the sections of the ordinance would not apply to them. And those three they did not agree with. There were probably maybe 14 or 15 other cases where they did. So I felt fortunate about that. But at this point in time, we'd be happy to do whatever's the pleasure of the board, and we'll work with the ag liaison. We've met with them 6 weeks ago on this package as it exists now, and there really weren't significant comments at that point in time, but now there may be. But we're happy to address those comments either now or at that point.
The package after it came back from the Coastal Commission?
Right. Well, no, it was actually before it went to the Coastal Commission.
That's the problem that we have. You talk to them. Right. Went to the Coastal Commission, but you
right.
haven't talked about the implications that the Coastal Commission, by making these changes in here, have to the agriculture community. And the agriculture community got to see this 2 days ago or so mm-hmm. in a consent agenda where they haven't seen any of the proposed changes coming back from the Coastal Commission. And I think we're missing some public process here.
Okay.
What? Ms. Bianchi, you had another comment?
Yeah, I have another question, and then I've got some comments after that. Let's assume for the sake of the argument that we accept this today. What are the options for changing it, those three or four issues in the future?
I think we have maximum flexibility, and we do intend to move forward on what we characterize as a phase two package of updates to our LCP, and that would be probably the most appropriate time. There is a 6-month, I believe, minimum time frame before you can resubmit an identical amendment, though.
Okay. No more questions, John.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Let me see if there's some other questions. We'll come back to comment.
I have a comment.
Mr. Ryan.
Yeah, I'll ask another question on your lead pages up here. You made a comment that an an important procedural note is that state law requires the county to accept all modifications. That's in the Coastal Act, that we have to accept all modifications. I thought that the Coastal Commission actually suggested modifications, and the county decided whether they could use them or not. It's sort of like local control. They can make suggestions, and we are the ones who make the final decision. I was wondering what state law says that we have to.
That's an excellent point. The only way, you know, changes to law in the Coastal Act will occur, or our local coastal plan, is if both the state and the county agree. So you're absolutely right. If we don't agree with these modifications, this LCP amendment can simply expire and go away and never take force and effect. So the intent of that section of the staff report was to say to have these changes take effect, and we think there's a lot of good reasons why they should, and it would be to agree to the modifications. Again, it's an all-or-nothing situation, unfortunately, and can no longer negotiate those changes.
They've told us for the last 8 years, while I've been here, 7 years, that it's been an all-or-nothing thing, and we haven't done the all-or-nothing thing. And now we're going through a phase process where we're agreeing to these, and then we're going to the next phase, and we're going to the next phase, which already is not an all-or-nothing thing.
So, true, by phasing it.
So, you know, so just saying it's an all-or-nothing thing is great, but in negotiations of trying to get something that works well for the county and well for the agricultural industry, and also the Coastal Act, is going to take some negotiation. And I think these that are being kicked out here and then put on consent agenda without the agriculture community even looking at them is not something that's that we need to do. I think
okay.
We need to get some feedback from the ag community.
Okay. Although I will point out that at their last meeting 6 weeks ago, these proposals were on the table. This was the original staff recommendation, and then it was adopted after their meeting.
The amendments were not. Ms. Bianchi?
One last question, John. I just want to get this. So there is an opportunity within a year to make modifications to this if we accept it today.
We can propose a new LCP amendment as part of our Phase 2 package.
Okay.
That's, and it'll go through that same process.
Thank you. That's kind of what I want to know. And then my comments are, you know, these are kind of esoteric discussions for people maybe who are not involved in either agriculture or the environment. And I happen to have one foot in one camp and one foot in the other, which sometimes really makes me feel like I'm doing the splits. But one of the reasons why it is very important to have buy-in from the agricultural community on environmental issues is that particularly in the coastal zone, where a great deal of the agriculture that is under concern is irrigated farmland, is that if the Coastal Commission requires standards or has requirements that are extraordinarily onerous to the agricultural community, and I will use the example of a coastal development. The proposal at one time for a coastal development permit to change crops or a coastal development permit if you change to a higher standard of development in an agricultural commodity, then you would have to have a coastal development permit. What that would have done is to stop the farmer from changing crops instantly to follow the market. And it's, you know, I drive past coastal farmland every morning and every night. And what a farmer has to do is if you're raising one thing and the market drops, you need to get rid of that crop and plant another one immediately. You can't wait for a coastal development permit. You know, it becomes an economically non-viable process. When it becomes too onerous, the chances are the farmer will just say, hey, forget it, I'm going to sell for development. And at that point, you've defeated the Coastal Act, because in the Coastal Act, agriculture and coastal-dependent uses are the highest and best use. So this is a real balancing act to make sure that agriculture in the coastal zone stays economically viable at the same time that we need to protect our environmental resources. And one event that I'm wondering if the Coastal Commission is even aware of, I know Joy Fitzhugh from Farm Bureau is very aware of it. The University of California, and I believe it's in cooperation with Farm Bureau, I didn't attend the courses, has been establishing what's called water quality short courses for agriculture in the coastal watersheds. And those water quality short courses have been attended by, I believe, the majority of landowners in the coastal watersheds. And I'm wondering if even the Coastal Commission is aware of what is happening in this county relative to those water quality short courses, which address the issues that the Coastal Commission is concerned about. So those are my comments.
The one comment, my understanding was that the Coastal Commission, due to personnel and some other funding issues, are not going to pay a lot of attention to periodic reviews. And we're going to go back to try to get the local coastal plans done.
John Ufrat from planning staff. They did make comments when they approved this package last month in San Diego that they would no longer be kind of micromanaging the county as it related to periodic review. That being said, amendments, again, to kick in, any changes to law or regulations need to have both parties agree. And we're one of the biggest advantages, we think, of this package is it does keep the control here locally, and that we feel it will reduce appeals from the Coastal Commission staff, which is a kind of a separate animal. And I just wanted to assure your board that the permit requirements for the ag industry that Supervisor Bianchi mentioned are not a part of this package, and I don't anticipate it. In fact, Coastal staff has pretty well dropped those proposals. And
I was just using that as an example of why we have to be able to.
That is where they started.
Yes.
I think, Mr. Ryan, you wanted to make a motion about referring this to the Ag Liaison and bring back in a couple of weeks?
Yes. Ag Liaison and to the Ag Task Force.
Ag Task Force.
And I believe a meeting of the Ag Task Force first something in April, first Wednesday. So if we can come back the
middle of April.
Second Tuesday in April.
All right. That's a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it because it's a date certain.
All right, so we're looking at the second meeting in April. Any other comments? Ms. Pinard?
Yeah, not specifically on that motion. I'm understanding that it's moving it forward to where we need to be, minus a change of a certain couple of days. But I did want to comment on one point that the speakers were making. One was on the timing and how long this has taken. And I think it's worth repeating that when those changes first came back to this board, it was on our agenda within a month. We passed them. It went on to the Coastal Commission and sat there for nearly 10 months. So let's just understand that this board is acting as quickly as it can. And in that case, it really went from 1 month to the next. That was pretty good for us. Yeah. But the second is that the point that we have phase one, and that somehow phase two and phase three won't even be started until phase one is done. There's stuff happening on phase two and phase three all the time. And one of the hardest parts of one of the future phases is watershed management, where we have so many property owners and so many interests with that. We're actually doing that already. So it's not like everything is sequential and we're waiting till phase one before anything else happens in phase two or phase three. In Pismo, in my district, the property owners along the creek, the Pismo Creek, are already meeting and trying to figure out what kind of watershed management plan they would like to have. The benefit of that, of course, is it's got the buy-in of the local people wanting to protect, and also the buy-in of the agencies. Regional Water Quality Control Board is there. Salmon Enhancement is there. So a lot of agency cooperation is occurring. So it isn't just sequential, that everything that's in the other phases is waiting and isn't going to happen until this is done. There's a lot of good things happening simultaneously. And I think that needs to be recognized because these people are doing it and giving their time and looking to do something that will benefit everybody for generations to come. Let's not acknowledge that, because that's a tremendous amount of time investment on their part for all of our benefit as well. So I just want to bring that up. I'm supportive of of moving these forward. I am understanding of the fact that when people are only given 2 days' notice, that's not really a great way to kind of move all of us forward. So I understand the need for the motion, but I am very supportive of the items that come forward, and I think Joy Fitzhugh said it best when she said that the issues, by and large, get us where we need to go and move us along.
Okay. So, with that, we have a motion on the floor. Roll call.
Mr. Ryan?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mrs. Pinard?
No.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt?
Aye. So item B2 then will be referred to the second meeting in April. With that, I'll accept a motion for the balance of the
second.
Moved by Mr. Ryan, seconded by Mr. Shajian. Roll call, please.
Mr. Ryan?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Mrs. Pinard?
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt?
Aye. With that, then, we will go now to our first hearing item, item C1. Madam Clerk, if you would, please.
Item C1 is a hearing to consider an appeal by Richard Norden, Frank and Barbara Sanchez, Michael and Nicole LaDonna, and John Shug of a Subdivision Review Board's decision to approve parcel map CO020189S020078P for Amanda and Chris Lane for property located at 6445 Squire Knoll Drive in Squire Canyon Area 3rd District. The recommendation is for this item to be continued to May 11, 2004.
All right.
Carrie O'Neill, County Planning Staff here. I just wanted to let you know that I have talked with both the appellant and the applicant, and they both have requested this continuance. And if you have any questions, I'm here.
Any questions? Seeing none, then we will move to the next item.
Well, I'd like to make the motion for the additional time for the continuation.
Need a motion?
Second that motion.
Moved by Ms. Pinard, seconded by Mr. Shajian. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Yes. Aye.
Opposed? So carried.
Good luck in your efforts.
Okay.
I know you're all working hard.
All right. We'll now go to item D1. You want to read that, Madam Clerk?
Item D1 is a consideration of a mosquito abatement program within the Public Health and Agriculture Department's all districts.
Mr. Edge.
Thanks, Chairman. Before the staff make the presentation, I just wanted to make a couple of comments on this item because, essentially, this, from a budgetary perspective, this couldn't come at a worse time in terms of what we'll be talking about. The staff from both Ag and Health will present you with findings and issues that that you need to hear about at this time of year because of the mosquito season, and that's why it's on your agenda. But you also need to be aware there was a misprint on the transmittal page, and the detail is in the memorandum that is part of the package in total. But you do need to realize the annual cost that we're talking about here is some $323,000 a year if you implement the particular program that's being described. There's a possibility that that kind of a program could be funded long-term through some kind of assessment, but any kind of assessment like that, a parcel assessment, does require a vote of the people. In the absence of a vote, there is no particular funding for this kind of a program. I don't know that I can tell you what's the right or wrong thing for you to do as the Board of Supervisors. That is your that's your bailiwick. I can tell you that we are looking, as you know, in general terms, we are looking at significant budget cutbacks going into next year, elimination of some 53 positions throughout the county, a lot of those focused in the health and welfare, environmental health, behavioral health areas. And how you balance that out against this particular need is a difficult one for you to deal with today. If you take no action, then I think Dr. Thomas will address if there is no issue throughout the summer, then we all breathe a sigh of relief and happy. If there is an outbreak of West Nile virus, then we are required to do an emergency response, and that emergency response will be expensive. I think the plan for this kind of program is to avoid ever getting to that stage and avoid the issues and the ramifications of an outbreak. But it is a difficult budget issue for you to wrestle with. I wanted to get that
Thank
out
you.
Front before you actually heard the presentation.
Mr. Thomas.
Good morning, Chairman Ovitt, members of the board. I am Dr. Greg Thomas, the Director of Public Health and the Health Officer. We're here to talk about a proposed mosquito abatement and surveillance program. As Mr. Edge noted, we are coming outside of the budget process because the mosquitoes indeed are breeding as we speak. Starting to hire for a mosquito control program in July and August is really too late to have a good response to mosquito control. It's being behind the eight ball. And indeed, not doing anything even after July and moving forward with an emergency response is likely to be a response, but too little too late to have a significant impact. This morning, Bob Lilly, Director of Agriculture Department, Rich Little, who's the entomologist or otherwise known as the bug man for ag and the county, will talk about the program. He's the man with the maps this morning. And Kurt Batson will talk about some details of the program description. Let's go to the next slide, please. West Nile virus was identified specifically in the 1930s in Africa and is recognized to be present in the Middle East and Europe, but was unknown in the United States. We were completely clear of West Nile virus until 1999 when it suddenly appeared in New York. Rich will go ahead and show you maps about the rapid spread of West Nile virus westward and why California is expected to be the epicenter. But basically, West Nile virus is spread by mosquitoes who have become infected by biting a bird. Most the birds are the reservoir hosts, and humans are the incidental infections, as are horses. Next slide. In the United States, as I talked about, this is a spreading disease. In 2002, there were 4,000 cases, approximately 284 deaths. In 2003, there were nearly 9,122 human cases, 218 deaths. And in the next slide, Colorado was the epicenter last year. It was hit because of the westward migration and because they had limited mosquito control and because they had a lot of mosquitoes last year. But they had a third of the cases in the United States last year, and they had 54 deaths in that relatively small state of Colorado compared to California. Very high direct medical costs. Next.
Just to Colorado, the $22 million?
Yes. California, as I said, is expected to be the epicenter. Rich, again, will show maps. It has moved into California very gradually. In 2001, there was one local which was considered to be a fluke, and then some imported cases from other states. It was very close to the Los Angeles airport, and probably it was a mosquito that took a free ride on a jet plane. 2003, there were three local and 17 imported cases, and indeed there were mosquitoes, birds, and horses infected in Southern California, just barely arriving in California. Next slide. I'd like to, I think it's important to point out what the clinical features are of West Nile virus. Many of those infected have no symptoms. Indeed, only 20% develop what is called West Nile fever. The incubation is between the bite and actually getting sick is 3 to 14 days, and generally one who develops West Nile fever, the mild disease, is sick for 3 to 6 days. Next slide. Next slide. The mild form, typically you'll have a sudden onset of fever, headache, body ache, nausea, vomiting, and may have a rash and swollen lymph nodes. Next slide. A severe infection, though, really is the main concern here. Approximately 1 in 150 will result in severe neurologic diseases, encephalitis, viral encephalitis being more common than viral meningitis. Indeed, it says 1 in 150 will develop serious neurologic illness. It is 1 in 50 of those who are over 65. It is of those under 65, it's 1 in 300. So there's a predominance to give severe neurologic symptoms in 65 is not elderly, looking as elderly as it used to, but over 65 certainly has a higher attack rate, and it shows up up there, the symptoms, can lead to coma, convulsions, serious muscle weakness, severe muscle weakness, and paralysis, kind of like a Guillain-Barré and a polio syndrome. Next slide. Unfortunately, treatment is supportive. Now, when we say medical community says the treatment is supportive, it basically means all we can do is give you intravenous fluids, Tylenol, various things for your headache, put you on a ventilator if you stop breathing, but we don't have an antibiotic that's effective for West Nile viruses. Next slide. So our program elements involve education. It's what we can do is reduce the mosquitoes and help people learn how to deal with the mosquitoes they have through things they can do in their own backyard in terms of reducing mosquito habitat, wearing appropriate clothing, staying out of the out-of-doors during the highest-risk periods, and using insect repellent, and making sure the screens on your doors and your windows are on the windows, actually, and not on the side of the house, and also working with the most sensitive populations, such as our some of our skilled nursing facilities, retirement communities. Next. Source reduction. Standing water is the source. Culex is the most common type of mosquito. It lives in stagnant water primarily. And so that things that you can do to treat and also reduce the sources of stagnant water are the most effective. Next. Surveillance has been ongoing. Bob Lilly is going to talk briefly about the history, but last year we started doing active surveillance, trapping live mosquitoes, looking at what types of mosquitoes there are, because there are only certain types, the Culex type that spread West Nile virus. And then we have some sentinel chicken flocks. They're out there getting bitten by mosquitoes, and we take a couple of drops of blood once a week to look to see if they become infected with West Nile virus. So they're kind of like the canary in the mine. Chickens, by the way, are not affected by West Nile virus for reasons we don't understand. And then we have a dead bird reporting program. We can send the birds to the state and have them studied. If it appears they're the right kind and they've been dead for a short enough period of time, they can be tested. Next. What can we do actively? We can do larvicide. These are mosquito dunks. They're available in farm equipment stores, farm supply stores. I ordered some on the internet last year, and what it is, it's called BTI, or Bacillus thiofringens. It's a bacteria that grows in the water. Mosquito larvae eat this bacteria, and it grows in the mosquito and blocks their intestinal system, and they die. So it's toxic to mosquito larvae. It is not toxic to other animals or insects. You can use that, leave that in for 3 to 4 weeks, and then you need to put in some more. Mosquito fish is another thing that we can do. We can put that in areas where the water does not flow into creeks and so that it doesn't take over steelhead habitat and such. Next slide. It can also be used, that BTI can be used as a granule, in granular form, uses with a belly grinder or other methods to spread into larger water bodies. We wouldn't use mosquito dunks in a large area, but they're good for backyard issues. Adulticiding, using very specific chemicals for adult mosquitoes would be a last resort, and one of the reasons we want to do this up front is to hopefully avoid the need to do adulticiding. Okay, at that point, that's kind of an orientation to West Nile virus, and we'd like to go into the history.
Morning, members of the board. Bob Lilly, County Ag Commissioner Sealer. To give your board a brief history on what's happened in the last 2 years in San Luis Obispo County, the Ag Department and the Health Department, realizing the critical importance of vector control services and the potential vulnerability that we have here locally without a program, we started to work together. And Initially, we developed the idea of forming a vector-controlled district, which is a special district that would provide these types of services, and that's how the services are typically provided in other parts of the state. So back in January of 2003, we came to your board with that concept, and your board funded $20,000 to hire a professional outfit to do a professional public opinion poll. And then in February, we came back to your board with the survey itself and made some changes and had that sent out. And then in March, we got the results of the public opinion poll. And at that point in time, your board decided to suspend the efforts of forming a vector control district. And we shifted the thought into mosquitoes. A vector control district is a really a broad concept towards vectors. In fact, one of the reasons the Ag Department was involved is that a typical vector control district would deal with red imported fire ant and African bee and that type of thing, which are classified as agricultural pests in the state code. And so that's why we started forming a joint program locally to share the responsibilities. So back in March then, your board appropriated $44,880 to get us started on a surveillance program for mosquitoes. Mosquitoes rose to the top of the priority list out of all the vectors out there, and so we at least needed to get a program started to determine where the mosquito hotspots were in the county and what type of mosquitoes we had and whether they were carrying West Nile virus or not. So that's a brief history. Next slide, please. So as far as the results, the next two slides will be the results of what we've delivered with that funding for the last year or so. We had the professional opinion poll results back in March of 2003. And this was a phone survey done with the citizens of the county. And the question was basically asked in pertaining to forming a vector control district if the public was willing to fund these services through a benefit assessment process. And so there's a lot of details in the survey, but to get to the bottom line, 46% to 50% said yes at that point in time that they were willing to fund the program through a benefit assessment program forming a vector control district. We did another survey through the same company. This was a mail-out survey, and the results just came in this month. And we shaped the question a little bit differently. The question now was talking about mosquito abatement services as a more narrow service than as a full-blown vector control district. And the results were had increased to 56 to 63% support of the public on forming a benefit assessment to fund this thing for long-term funding. So when we're talking about a benefit assessment, the dollar amounts that we're talking about, although we're asking for the money out of the general fund now to get this program started, but as a potential long-term funding source for this program, the question was asked for $7 a year for a single-family residence as an assessment on the property tax rolls, but that was basically how the question was framed for these types of services that would generate enough money to provide the services. And so that was in relationship to the response. The company that we hired have told us that it takes a 50 plus one, a simple majority, of a mail-out ballot in order to fund the benefit assessment if we chose to go that route into the future. But that would take at least 2 years to do that type of a process to get the thing funded in that manner. Next slide, please. So the specific program results then that we've had, this would be for the calendar year 2003. We did a lot of mosquito trapping. We've determined the hot spots in the county, mostly in the coastal areas, although we haven't surveyed a whole lot in the inland areas of the county. We have identified the variety of mosquitoes. That's important because some types of mosquitoes are better vectors of disease than others, so that's an important information to have. And we've tested for West Nile virus, and we've done that in three ways. We've tested the mosquitoes themselves to see that whether they carried the virus. We had the sentinel chicken flocks, as Dr. Thomas mentioned. And then we have a dead bird call-in system where birds that have died, because that's usually the first indicator that it's hit. And so far the results have been negative that we have West Nile virus here, at least at the detectable levels. So in addition to that, we've developed a big public information display that we've taken out throughout the county last year, getting the word out in various locations. We've developed an emergency response plan that the Mr. Edge spoke about that we would have to use if we didn't have a preventative program. We have prepared this program for today and developing a, you know, a mosquito abatement program for your board's consideration. And we've been working with the environmental coordinator to see if there's any issues with an environmental determination. And in looking in the scope of the program, the application of pesticides appears to be really the only issue that might be subject to an environmental determination. And as you might know, in California, we have a CEQA certified pesticide program. And so we're evaluating whether that is enough in itself to address the environmental issues. And also, it doesn't take an action of your board for county staff to go out and apply pesticides. So that's certainly covered through the CEQA equivalency program, which the state controls. And there might be certification and training and licensing requirements in order for the staff to actually apply the pesticide, but it doesn't take board action to do that. So that concludes my part of the presentation. I'll turn it over to Rich.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the board, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share the information I've been collecting over the past couple of years. What you see here on the screen now are some headlines that occurred in Colorado last year, and they were representative of many areas of the country. Just to give you a quick background, this area right here in 1999 is where we first picked up West Nile virus. And what I'm going to show you is a series of slides to show you how rapidly this problem has moved across the country. 1 year later, in 2000, we have this area here. 1 year after that, 2001, it's scattered over the east. 1 year after that, it becomes this. That's 2002. These red areas represent human cases. Last year, or 1 year after this, it went to this. This year, I don't know. These cases, like I said, are representing human ones, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Right now, West Nile virus is found in 46 states and thousands of counties. Since 1999, we've had over 14,000 human cases. When I talk about that, I'm talking about people who have been diagnosed with West Nile virus through blood testing or some other means. There are tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of others who have acquired West Nile virus but did not develop any symptoms. So far, with the exception of Maine, Oregon, and Washington, we have found human cases in all states. Colorado was ground zero last year. We had almost 3,000 cases in Colorado. About 861 of those cases required hospitalization. The average stay was approximately 2 weeks, and cost Colorado almost $23 million just for direct medical costs alone. In a follow-up interview with a lot of these people after they were hospitalized, several weeks later, about 37% of them were still unable to return to work. Some of them had long-term paralysis. So this cost here does not represent lost productivity, human times, or all the other things that are associated with it. One thing that came out of this conference that I attended last month in Denver was what happened in those areas where we had so many cases. And what we were able to determine based on some of these cases, and I'll show you some examples, is that those people that lived outside of an area that had any kind of mosquito control were on the average 10 to 40 times more likely to acquire West Nile virus if the area had it. In addition to humans, we have to talk about the birds. There's over 220 different species of birds that have West Nile virus. Several of them, the American crows in particular, we feel are the primary means that West Nile virus is distributed around the country. Like what Dr. Thomas was talking about earlier, that mosquito has to bite the bird. And the American crow is the biggest one. We have 49 different species of mosquitoes where we have found West Nile virus in. A number of those species do occur here in this country, or this county. Okay, back to the human part. This map here is 2002. Those red dots represent 100 cases of West Nile virus per 1 million population. 1 year later, which was this past year, we were facing this situation. You can see sort of like a wave moving across. Why do we not have more red dots over here in the east? That's a question a lot of people are asking, and myself as well. And apparently there are two answers to that question. One is many of these areas, such as New York City and the others, now have a much more sophisticated mosquito control program that they did not have prior to the arrival of West Nile virus. The other reason is weather did not favor the breeding of mosquitoes as it did in 2002 in these areas along the East Coast. In 2003, this part of the country was very favorable to breeding mosquitoes. Over here in 2004, I don't have the answer yet. As try as I have so many times, I've not been able to change the weather. So until that happens, we're going to have to guess. Intervention. That's the key. And the reason why we need to think about that is I have a jar here full of mosquitoes. These were collected last night, one drop, in Black Lake Canyon. I have several others. This one is from Morro Bay. So you see the mosquitoes are out there right now, and they are breeding. It's my particular feeling that even though we have not detected West Nile virus in this county, it is probably here, but it will be sometime before we are able to detect that. Even though you see not that many mosquitoes by my estimation in one night, I can show you another jar here. This is also one night's catch, but that was in July. So you can see the numbers are going to go up quite significantly as we get further into that. And I'll show you some examples of how vector control districts and mosquito abatement control districts in particular are effective. This area here represents Cook County in Illinois. Down here in this blue area is the city of Chicago to help place this map. This county has four mosquito abatement districts. We have the North Shore, South Cook, the DP, and the Northwest one. You see these circles right here represent a significant number of West Nile virus human cases versus the other districts. And the biggest differences between these two districts and the others is what they did in terms of mosquito control. The larvicide efforts of these two districts was average or very restrictive. Likewise, the adulticide efforts of these two districts were also less than average. The other districts where we had very few cases had very intensive mosquito control program. So we can say, based on this, just from this one county alone, those areas that have mosquito control are a lot less likely to have human cases versus a district. We can use another one. This is California. These areas in greens, that is, those areas have some type of mosquito abatement program, be it a vector control program or something like that. Now, land area-wise, these programs only cover about 42% of the land. So the map is misleading in terms of that because we don't have many mosquitoes out there, nor do we have people. On the other hand, 88% of the people in California are under some type of mosquito control program. That means these people living in the white areas, using the data that CDC has been able to generate over the past couple of years, is we can say those people are 10 to 40 times more likely to become infested with West Nile virus when that area becomes infested with it. Education, as Dr. Thomas indicated, is extremely important. These areas and the regions in the country represent the percentage of people surveyed that have taken some type of precaution, have listened to educational programs and things like that to help protect them against West Nile virus. As you can see over here in the West Coast, we're less than 18%. Where in places like the central area, 32% of the people take precaution. Down in the South is 46%. How did this come about? In West Nile virus, when it entered these regions, there was a significant jump in the number of people that took it upon themselves to take those precautions to protect themselves. Due to the nature of the mosquitoes that we're dealing with, there's no way any kind of control program is going to ever eradicate all of them. If that were possible, mosquitoes would have been eradicated long, long time ago. We do, however, have the option of significantly reducing the number of mosquitoes and the number that are infected. But even on top of that, we have to educate the people. They have to understand some of those things that they can take, self-precautions to protect themselves. In California, we have no questions at all that West Nile virus is going to do very well. When I talked to the CDC officials that put this conference on last month, I asked them, what should we expect, especially in a place like San Luis Obispo County? His parting words were, you will be extremely amazed. You will have absolutely no clue as to what you are about to encounter, nor the speed in which it is going to happen. We will be watching you closely. So, how is it going to get here? We already know it is in the southern part of the state. We have some significant areas that we need to be concerned with. If we look at people and means of bringing the mosquitoes in, down in the southern part of the state, with the exception of Tahoe, most of the interstates going back and forth are coming in the southern part of the state. This is also the area where the Pacific Flyway goes. We do know birds are going to be moving this. We do know Mexico is infested. All of Mexico, except for the southern part of Baja, has West Nile virus. All of Canada, except for British Columbia, has West Nile virus. It is only the west coast of North America that is left yet untouched. And that will change rapidly. This was the situation in California in December. These red M's represent positive cases of West Nile virus found in mosquitoes. And the blue C's represent positive cases in the chicken flock. The black B's represent dead bird cases. Now, in this county, we are utilizing all these means of surveillance to give us some kind of a clue as to what may be happening out there. Because we need as much lead time as we can possibly get to start dealing with these areas where the mosquitoes are breeding and to start the educational process to make people understand they do have some control over that. West Nile virus is a fearsome disease. Even though it hasn't killed millions, it does affect the country in a lot of ways, as you can see what's been happening. So, with that case, I'm going to turn it over how we're going to do this.
Supervisor Overt, members of the board, my name is Kurt Batson. I'm the Director of Environmental Health, and I have the pleasure of discussing the cost of this program. What's before you this morning is a request to provide general fund support that would provide about $68,800 to the Public Health Department and about $13,800 for the Agricultural Commissioner for current fiscal year. That's between now and July 1st. These costs are one-time costs, they're fixed assets, and they're staffing, assuming we can get staffing on board and by June 1st. For next fiscal year 04-05, the Public Health Department is requesting $242,000 in general fund support, and the Agriculture Commissioner, $80,000, for a total cost of about $323,000. The staffing for this program includes a half of a full-time equivalent supervisor, one full-time employee for the agricultural department in the form of an agricultural technician, a half of a FTE for a health education specialist, and three environmental health aides who are temporary help seasonal employees. They will be here 7 months a year, and then they will be gone. The other positions are all limited-term positions. The supervisor for the program, his main responsibilities are to implement the mosquito abatement program, and he's responsible for implementing not only this program, but if your board approves, also the waste tire enforcement program. As you saw in one of the one of the pictures in the presentation, one of the issues with waste tires is a vector harborage, and one of the main vectors that they harbor are mosquitoes, because they collect water and mosquitoes grow in them very well. The supervisor is also charged with planning and implementing these programs in coordination with the State Department of Health Services, the Department of Pesticide Regulation, Regional Water Quality Control Board, Department of Fish and Game, and the California Integrated Waste Management Board. He or she is also responsible for policies and procedures for the program. These are both new programs. They will require quite a bit of development work. This person is responsible for the activities, supervising the activities of the health education specialist, the environmental health specialists in the waste tire grant, and the three environmental health seasonal aides. Also, he'll be representing environmental health services and community groups. We can expect that this mosquito abatement program is somewhat controversial, and we're going to need a lot of outreach. The agricultural technician, primarily responsible for the monitoring and surveillance activities in the program. The health education specialist is also responsible for, of course, outreach to the public and advising people on what they can do in their homes. What they can do to prevent exposure to mosquito-borne diseases, and help educate senior citizens about the risks of West Nile virus. The environmental health aides are the field treatment responsibilities, and they will be doing the control agent applications and the field activities. So why now? Well, the jar that we passed around is one reason. The mosquitoes are here now. The peak breeding season is probably comes around mid-May. And we will need at least a couple of months to hire and train staff to get them here. That puts us in June. So we're already behind the peak part. And our goal is, again, to get these people hired and trained by early June. And given our current situation, that our treatment strategy will be to first focus on those hotspot areas that we know exist, particularly those that are near sensitive populations. We will then follow through with treating other known breeding areas. And that concludes my presentation and the presentation.
I have one just quick final comment, and that is in other areas of the United States and other parts of the world, there is a crescendo of activity of West Nile virus that between the mosquitoes and the birds builds up and typically hits in late July, August, and September. So those are the times that if other states' experiences are the same as California's, and we can't guarantee that, but typically that crescendo that hits in August, September, and October will be what we're trying to avert.
That concludes your presentation. That will go to the board for questions. Mr. Assayan.
Thank you, Chairman Ovid. Thank you. That was a great presentation. I'd like to take a moment and welcome Dr. Davis, public health biologist from the state. I'm looking forward to hear from you. Two questions. One is, Mr. Lilly said it will take about 2 years to go to the ballot and have the benefit area assessed. If we were to do that, and if we have done preventive medicine, so to say, and at a later date we achieve that goal, would we be able to put money back into the general fund if everything was under control and we had access?
I can answer.
Link?
Yeah. The way that works is what we're looking at is working on a ballot probably this fall is what we would be doing. The money that might, if it were approved, the money actually would be, we wouldn't see it till like January of 06. If it were approved, then that money could pay for fiscal year 05-06. But it's our understanding that it could not pay for fiscal year 04-05. So it could go back, but it only to the beginning of that fiscal year.
My other question is, obviously from your presentation, it's coming. It's already here. It can get worse. But we do absolutely nothing about it. And then we're hit by an emergency to take care of the problem. What is your estimate as what would the cost be at that time?
Kurt had done an estimate, a wild estimate, general estimate of what the costs would be of that emergency response. It was based on last year doing approximately 6 weeks of mosquito control, and it estimates what we would have to do is take people who are dedicated to other jobs in public works and in general services, take them off their current jobs as rangers aides at the golf course, at various other areas, some of the star thistle control people, and take them off those jobs and put them in it as an emergency. And at that point, we're talking, you can only take them off their usual jobs for a certain amount of time. And so I did not bring the amount that we estimated would cost, but some of those would be.
Give us a ballpark.
More or less?
It would be less.
Yes.
I can say, but we estimated it for a six-week period, not for, and again, it's unknown exactly when this is going to hit. But at the time last year, it was a little better. It was a little easier to predict that we had 6 weeks left in the season that we would have to depend upon this emergency response.
Of course,
but $121,000 is the amount that we had estimated at that time.
We don't necessarily know how hard we could get hit, and that is just a guesstimate.
And we wouldn't know how soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you wouldn't know how many people would have been affected already. And the severity of their having been affected.
Yeah. And using Dr. Thomas's earlier comment, it's somewhat like closing the barn door after the horse is out.
Absolutely.
How effective it would be you could only do the best you could, which would probably be depending more on adulticiding than larvaciding. You would probably already have had a lot of people exposed. So if you wait till after the emergency hits, it's going to be less effective than trying to prevent it.
So the $121,000 would only be the cost to the county. It would not be the total cost, people in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Ryan.
Yeah, if you didn't take corrective measures ahead of time, what's it do to the following year? If we go out now and we do this program and we have West Nile virus move in, but we're pretty effective in our education and the way we're doing everything, what's that do to the following year? And if we don't do this and we have an outbreak, what's that do to the following year?
I'm going to make I don't think the answer is absolutely known, so I'm going to make an educated guess that it's not going to make a big difference, that it's a year-to-year problem, except for the fact that there is some overwintering of mosquitoes. But each year you have an independent bird migration that's going to bring the virus in. You get this buildup of mosquitoes biting birds, biting humans. And so I think you have to take each year at a time.
Any other questions? Let me ask a couple. You've got $84,000 in the financial section for the balance of this year. Half of it seems, is taken up in capital equipment. and the other half is salary. Is that correct?
I think I have that information here.
It's very close, yes.
That's
46,
very close.
That's 46, 49. My question is, first of all, I know we've got to have excess trucks, and we, you know, because you got two computers and laptops and everything. The central's a huge thing you might have to get, but we also have a public health lab. I assume you're going to be working with them. And I guess I'm questioning this capital need all of a sudden for two new trucks and you know three computers, two permanent that. And then the second part of the question is the personnel are going to be paid for, as I understand, from the tire abatement program, and yet you show personnel cost in this. Now, I need to get an explanation of that.
Sure, I can answer that. If your board approves the waste tire enforcement program.
We did.
Yeah. That begins July 1st, so that would not pay for anything in this fiscal year. So that funding source begins July 1. As far as some of your comments on the capital, the vehicles, and some of the equipment and that sort of thing, I suppose you could phase some of that in and then determine that specific need as it went along. But some of those, the vehicles in particular, this is a rather vehicle-intensive sort of operation. We're talking about three people traveling around the county simultaneously, in addition to a vehicle for the surveillance activities. So we're already going to be sharing the two vehicles amongst the four people fairly consistently. So we felt that two vehicles would be sort of the minimum at this point in time.
But I saw no money for basically prevention materials. In other words, the eradication or the larvicide.
There was
nothing in there on that.
Actually, there is. It was under other category. There's about $17,000 of expenses that weren't explicitly explained that would be included for the purchase of those kinds of things.
Second question is, in July 1, the tire abatement program hits, it pays for the personnel. Where do we come up with $300,000?
Let me answer the staffing. The only staff that the recycled tire grant pays for is for half of a supervising environmental health specialist. The idea being that you could assign that mosquito abatement program oversight to be a 20-hour a week activity, and the recycled tire grant a 20-hour a week. So it's one staff person shared between those two. It seemed like a synergy. It cut the cost to both programs. If you have a half-time supervising environmental health specialist, a half-time health education specialist, a full-time agricultural technician doing year-round surveillance, and then you have 3 7-month employees, that's that plus the materials and things like 10 hours of helicopter time to use the larvicide material. You know, you get into expensive materials in addition to staff in order to have an effective an effect on the mosquito population. That's how you come up with the 300.
I didn't see that breakdown. Just like the thing of the larvicide for this year is put in other.
Yeah.
And if the primary issue is education and the primary issue is vector control to begin with, it seems like more money should be spent in that direction than it was in the capital improvements that we were talking about. Mr. Ryan.
I already got the answer. I was asking how long that tire money would.
It's 5 years.
Yeah, so it's 5 years to cover.
Ms. Pinard.
Yeah, maybe I'm trying to be a little more practical here, but when we talk about things starting July 1st, I'm kind of going, there's mosquitoes breeding out there right now, and mosquito abatement, to me, would be an ordinary county program that should be ongoing. I mean, you mentioned in an earlier discussion prior times that we've gone out and done mosquito abatement. So I'm wondering why the obvious isn't happening, and that is that you have the ability with a number of these locations, our standing pools with no creek outlet. There's the one at Chumash, certainly the ones in front of Kmart, people have been calling in where very large standing pools are, why we're not doing mosquito fish out there now. We're going out there measuring it. We're catching the mosquitoes. But just on a normal program of keeping the number of mosquitoes in a reasonable number, we're not doing that. And so we're going to miss this whole cycle by saying that everything's starting July 1st. I thought that was part of the reason we funded what we did months ago, was to get a jump start on not only identifying the things that you've done, identified very well, and I understand that's very important. But the other is just the obvious of going out and using the fish where you can, and beginning, we said at that point, of educating people and using the media about standing water and getting that off so that this whole year right now can be a success in preparation for what else you're going to do, rather than saying, well, we're not doing anything. We got $68,000, and basically what we did was identify some of the things we already knew.
I'd like to address that. We were very clear in the board letter last year that this was money for surveillance and some education, very limited. And we are working with very limited staff at this point. We had that discussion yesterday, and Mr. Batson's going to show you the distribution of what environmental health staff are currently doing in mandated programs. We have done a significant amount of education in relation to working with the press, with the media, and website, television, and flyers. But there's a lot more that we can do and that we should be doing. And so I agree, July 1st is too late. That's why we're here in March to jumpstart this so that we're not waiting to July 1st to get the program going.
Yeah, Mr. Bianchi, and then what we're going to do is we're going to go to public comment. We'll finish public comment, and we will break for the noon recess. A closed session will be after that, and we will finish our conversation and our decision on this after lunch, because some others have some obligation during lunch hour. Thank you.
Yep, my understanding is that the July 1st is for the waste tire abatement program to start, not everything else. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, our hope is to actually get started as soon as we can get some people on board. So that was only the funding for the waste tire grant.
Okay, thank you.
And what we're going to do now is we'll go to the public comment. And as I said, when we finish public comment, we will break for the lunch hour. We will come back at 2 o'clock and finish this item, and we will have closed session after we finish the last item of the day. So with that, we'll start with Eric Greening, and then we are followed by Dr. Richard Davis.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening. The staff report is written to reassure about moving forward and is structured to call attention to the good and reassuring parts while leaving things unsaid about the scary parts. Source reduction is the first line of defense. Fine. Biological larval control is the second line of defense. Fine. But the third line of defense is vaguely outlined, not filled in. Most of my questions grow from page 7. At the top, it talks about Michigan comparing counties with and without mosquito abatement districts and number of cases of West Nile virus. My question is, how many cases of pesticide-related illness or death occurred in abatement counties? We may never know, since not everyone receives medical attention, much less medical attention that draws the connection between illness and pesticide exposure. But until we take injury and death from spraying into account, we only have one side of the equation. The next paragraph says that control measures on an individual parcel basis are not effective with large-scale outbreaks. It sounds like, without openly so stating, preparations for possible large-scale adulticide spraying operations are included, and it would not be possible to avoid spraying individual parcels occupied by people on the pesticide-sensitive registry. Is this true? How much warning would the public receive in advance of such large-scale spraying? Would the district compensate people displaced by the spraying, short or long term? Would the district have resources to deal with liability claims in the event of pesticide-related injury or death to the public? Would the district have tax-supported lawyers contesting claims made by people so injured or bereaved? Exactly what chemicals are on the list to be used, and what sort of testing have the ingredients undergone? Ultimately, pesticides are addictive and counterproductive as any other form of substance abuse. Most of the poison harms non-target organisms. Meanwhile, resistant mosquitoes can quickly breed, their numbers no longer contained by the swallows and dragonflies which have been poisoned. Would even stronger sprays then be resorted to? This sounds like the addictive spiral familiar to anyone who has lived around a drug abuser, only it's not an individual or family that hits bottom, but all of us. My first choice, if you move forward with this district, is that it be restricted to the first and second lines of defense. The ounce of prevention is our greatest value. My second choice would be to have the third line of defense better described and full environmental review completed before it can be resorted to. But again, we need to know whether we can compare West Nile virus cases plus chemical injury cases on both sides of the equation before we have a full equation. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Richard Davis, followed by Karen Mansfield.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Dr. Richard Davis. I'm representing the California Department of Health Services. And you, hopefully you've received a letter from our department. And basically, I'd like to paraphrase some of that. Many of it's already been covered. But our department really supports the efforts of the county, the Board of Supervisors, and a lot of the hard work and effort gone into this to appropriate funding for development and implementation of a mosquito abatement program. It's certainly very evident. We've seen the spread of West Nile virus across the country, and now it's the introduction into California with three human cases. I don't think there's any question about the fact that it will be here, and will be here shortly. If it's not already here, we have all these conjectures and bets going on as to whether it's here or not. But at any rate, experience elsewhere, as you've heard about, certainly demonstrates that the cost of West Nile virus can be certainly extensive, and the loss to human businesses and various other things. And California is very, very fortunate to have a very extensive mosquito control program in many local areas throughout the county, throughout the state. Unfortunately, San Luis Obispo County is one of those particular areas not covered by a mosquito control program. I'm basically it. I don't particularly like being it. I have a very large district. I cover essentially from Malibu north to Monterey and over to Kern County, Visalia area as well. Anyway, as you heard today, and I will reiterate, it's very critical that San Luis Obispo County move quickly and develop a mosquito control program, really a comprehensive program, including a lot of the educational efforts. Those areas within the United States that have a comprehensive program, you saw one example, there are a number of other examples where they did have a program in place. It was very, very effective in reducing the number of impact to not only humans, but to horses and to our wild bird population as well. The real backbone of a mosquito vector control program is the proactive action, somewhat in response to what you said. And virtually all of the mosquito control activities in California that have been going on for many, many years are really using larvicides, not using pesticides, to control most of the mosquito problems. And by being proactive, you can use materials that have a very, very limited or non-effect to humans and the environment. So anyway, so that's one of the major urges that we address the situation now before it really has a major impact.
I'd ask you to conclude, Mr. Davis.
Okay.
Your 3 minutes, if you would conclude.
Okay. And I'd like to thank the county for supporting the fledgling program that got started last year. And I'm also a resident of the county and concerned from a personal standpoint. Thank you.
Karen Mansfield, followed by Joy Pitchew.
Karen Mansfield, Executive Director of San Luis Obispo County Agricultural Task Force. Just want you to know that we support the program. We're in favor of it.
Thank you. Joy Fitchew, followed by Reverend C. Height.
Yes, Joy Fitzhugh, San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau. Of course we support the program. That's something that agriculture has had to deal with for many years. And Farm Bureau would be very pleased to be part of helping with the education of this through information dissemination sooner than later. I think part of the dissemination is letting people know where they can get the mosquito fish, where they can get the larvicide, and we would be happy as Farm Bureau to be part of that facilitation of getting that information out, not just to our membership, but to the whole community. Also, our veterinarians need to be given a word of congratulations at this point because they have been pushing the vaccination of horses for over 2 years, and I think a large portion of our horses in San Luis County have been vaccinated against West Nile virus.
All mine have. Reverend C. Height.
Your mules.
No, mules and horses. I have both. Followed by Charlie Knopf.
I'm Reverend C. Height. I have reactive respiratory disease from my work as an artist, and I thank you and NIOSH thanks you for preventing the release of airborne silica in this room. There was a liability. I am enjoying improved health and have concerns about pesticide application along Pismo and Arroyo Grande Creek. I want to ask Dr. Thomas, is this county prepared to responsibly consider the health and compensation equally to all citizens? And here's some examples of liability and failed response. In 2001, there was a broken sewer line. The sewer was replaced. Somehow I was not treated at FCC clinic because my doctor was told by the county, and this went through the health department, there was no broken sewer line. Morro Bay toxic spill, 2001. Well, the press eliminated all of the disabled and all of the infirmed people that were at the Red Cross Center. And there was no notification to these people that they had a choice to decide whether they would receive any type of compensation from this, but they simply were not notified by the county or the health department. And I would suggest there probably is not any record when anyone went to the doctor and suggested that they were in the toxic spill. I imagine there is no record. There certainly isn't on mine that we were actually there. Moving on. And this is a matter of responsibility. This is what it cost to be able to communicate last year, Dr. Thomas. This is part of comes back to my IRS medical deductions. The second name on this card, this is the rabies vaccine card, and yes, neurological problems is a very sad thing, and you can expect that from rabies shots. Now, I had these rabies shots from County Health, but there is nothing in my record that shows that a doctor ever counseled me and told me about the neurological problems. How was I responded to? Well, this is what happens when you get mauled on a public beach and someone thinks that you might sue the county. You know, this is the complaint form that certainly has a lot of blanks. Now, my question is, you know, are you prepared to be responsible? Have you been responsible? Or is a person of my disability and of my low social class just going to be one of the people that falls through the cracks? Should I happen to appear at the only clinic, which is now run by the county, and have my health problems, which are associated with my reactive respiratory disease, my fibromyalgia, and severe allergies? How will I be treated?
Thank you. Charlie Knopflett.
Charlie Knopflett. This kind of reminds me of my childhood in Indiana, walking through wet grass and having clouds of mosquitoes come off of the ground. And then again at Cape Canaveral in the early days, seeing those trucks with the big sprays going all around with DDT. So I'm not an expert on mosquitoes, but I've been around some of the effects many times. One thing I've noticed, I've been here 15 years now, and I've seen maybe 6 mosquitoes in my place. We sleep with the door windows open. No screen. Well, we have screens, but we have open windows too. I've wondered about that, and then I realized after talking with my neighbor, Dr. Lindbergh, he had some bat houses, and he was explaining that bats eat thousands and thousands of mosquitoes every night. And I'm wondering if could get the kids in the schools to build those bat houses and put them everywhere. And I don't know whether those mosquitoes can pass it on to the bats. Maybe that would be a problem. But I think that's something to consider. It's a serious way of really reducing the mosquitoes. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to make comment on this particular item? There has been a request because some board members have obligations during the lunch hour that what we'll do now is we'll recess for the lunch hour. We'll return at 2 o'clock, and we will finalize decision on this particular item, and we'll go to closed session after that. Seeing no other discussion, we stand in recess till 2 o'clock. Okay, we'll call a Board of Supervisors meeting back to order. We are on item is it D1, and we finished with public comment, and we're bringing it back to the board. We did ask, or I did ask over the lunch period to review this fact that I just want to clarify one thing that we were talking about doing a forming of the district by voting in the benefit assessment. Mr. Lindholm and them looked it up. Would you mind clarifying this, Mr. Lindholm, where we're at?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you asked the question whether this would require greater than a majority vote and whether it was really a tax. The answer is no. It's a benefit assessment, and it's determined based upon the benefit which will accrue to the parcels that are paying the assessment, and it's calculated on that basis. So
but this
it
only
qualifies as a benefit assessment.
But it would only be voted on by the property owners and not the electorate.
That's correct.
And okay, so it should be the whole county. It shouldn't be just it's
countywide.
Isn't countywide, yeah, because that was what they're talking about. Okay, with that, we brought it back. I think about the only question that was brought up was spraying for the adult side. Give me the correct term on that, but Mr. Thomas, if you want to clarify that.
Yes, the adulticiding is a term for using some very focused pesticide products, not your general pesticide, malathion or anything like that. I mean, there are memories of medfly. Rich Little can discuss a bit if you'd like some more details. But again, adulticiding is something that is a last-ditch resort. It's something that I would hope we would not have to do this summer, next summer, or any other summer, that other mosquito control activities would preclude the need for it. And if you don't have cases, significant number of cases of West Nile virus, you're not going to go through and knock down the adult population of mosquitoes. It's much more effective to dry up the sources of mosquitoes breeding and treat with larvicides, which is a it's challenging to even call it a pesticide because it is a bacteria that is eaten specifically by bacteria larvae. Bob can talk about the chemically sensitive population registry that they've used for the glassy wing sharpshooter. We would anticipate if we have to do the adulticiding at some time that we would use a similar process.
Well, I'm going to open it back up to board, Mr. Sajjan.
Thank you. Vaccination. Have we considered that as a preventive approach, or have any cost estimates? How much would that cost if we were to offer it free for those who cannot afford it? Or would a minimum?
Works great for horses.
Only?
And they're using the horse vaccine on birds, but it's not authorized for use on humans. They think that a human vaccine is perhaps 3 or 4 years away. It could be longer. There is no human vaccine at this time.
As we speak, there is no human vaccine. Yeah, I heard the other comment from Ms. Fitch this morning.
Ms. Bianchi?
So my question is, I kind of want to reemphasize and correct me if I'm wrong, that the emphasis will be on prevention with the any pesticide uses of one would hope absolute distance final action. That pesticides are not the first line of defense.
They are the very last line of defense.
Very last.
I need to get that corrected because this preliminary thing we're talking about is the use of some kind of materials which will kill the larva, and that's part of our prevention. So I don't want anybody to be misinformed that if we look for this year, we're going to go to an active situation for larva. If the situation gets worse, then the ultimate is the adulticide that we were talking about.
That's correct. The BTI, the Bacillus thiofringens, is a registered pesticide, but it is a specific biologic agent for mosquito larvae.
Multiple use of all kinds of different things. You know. Yeah. Mr. Ryan, then we'll go to Ms. Bernard.
Yeah, just to, I believe that we need to do this. That's, I think we can get there pretty easily, that we need to set up some way to go after the mosquitoes so we don't have an outbreak of West Nile, because it's going to cost us way more if we sit and wait for it. But then we go to the other side of it, and which goes to every issue we ever talk about, and that's money and how we're actually going to do that. Have your departments looked at everything that you're doing and weighed this in the priorities of what you are doing and looked internally at reprioritizing and doing some of this funding? You have some of the funding coming from the waste tire program, but have you looked at going inside and reevaluating priorities? And if this is coming on and we know it's going to be here, shouldn't this rise to the top of our priorities? And should we not reprioritize and make the shifts inside our departments rather than going out and hiring new people and setting up limited term employees and a whole bunch of other things that we could use from inside? And then we're going towards the budget problem that we know is coming up here. Everyone's going to be cutting. Everyone's going to be looking at their priorities and how to scale back and meet those priorities. Shouldn't we look at that before we step in here ahead of the budget and drop in another $300,000 to make this program fly?
We have looked at prioritizing. We have mandated functions in environmental health that we are providing. And if we reassign people, we are currently on the border of meeting restaurant inspection, hazmat facility inspections, and there are some other areas. Frankly, staff is working on biosolids. That's a non-mandated function, but other than the biosolids issue, I'm hard-pressed to say where staff is working on non-mandated areas in environmental health other than investigating complaints, which may have public health significance. We don't know whether they have public health significance until we get out there and see the complaints.
I think one thing that would help the board is seeing the priorities and the staffing levels meeting the priorities you have, so we have an idea where we are in the department to see if there is something that we could use internally rather than going for all this externally.
From the standpoint of the Ag Commissioner's Office, mosquito surveillance and abatement is not a mandated program for the Ag Commissioner. We deal with many insect pests, but this one's not categorized as an agricultural pest, so it's not a mandated, and we won't get any reimbursement from the state either, as we would dealing with agricultural pests. So if I had to prioritize, I would have to place the priority on the control of the agricultural pest over the mosquitoes.
Even though the mosquitoes will drop some of your horses and birds and everything else, doesn't that have some sort of an effect on agriculture?
Yes, it certainly does, but in an effort to balance my budget, it doesn't qualify for state revenue, and I depend on state revenue to balance my budget.
Nope. we look at the end outcome has to be one of the main things we look at when we're setting priorities. You know, and if mosquitoes don't come up to the priority because, you know, they don't balance your budget, well, which is more important, the end outcome of not having the West Nile virus or your budget?
I mean, we can make those decisions as we go, but it, as I said, it's not a mandated program for my department or a funded program, and those are the kinds of factors that we have to consider when we make priority decisions.
Ms. Bernard?
Yeah, I'd like to kind of pick up on that line of reasoning because we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and I just asked how many people there were in both of your departments, and there are 66 and a half positions that, between the two of you, 44 in ag and 22 and a half in environmental health. And I'm leaning the exact same way, and I know it's not going to come as any surprise to you after our discussion yesterday. We know we need to do something, and we need to do it now. And even by your own comments earlier that you were hoping somebody could come on board by July 1st, that misses this whole cycle. And I really do see this as a management issue of how we do and utilize our resources. I understand that there are always going to be competing demands, so I do appreciate that. But, you know, with the preface that Mr. Edge gave, in a couple of months, we're going to be making a lot more serious prioritizing of our personnel and our programs. And I think we need to start right now, right here. We can, I believe, shift some people and start reprioritizing what we do to get you're only talking about a couple of people. And out of 66 people, if we can't shift enough of the responsibilities and who's doing what to be able to cover this, then I think this is only a prelude to what's going to be happening in June when we go through the budget. I believe it can be done. I'd like to see, and I'd like the CEO to be able to see, what the list of activities are that are already going. And I know they're all legit. I mean, I'm not saying somebody's sitting around not doing something. But when we prioritize and we say, given these jobs, what is the most important thing to do right now? And you've got staff available right now. We don't need to wait until July to bring someone new on board to make this happen. And I think it's a challenge that you're having to be one of the first ones to face, but every other department is going to also be needing to face the same thing in a couple of months. That $15 billion bond that was just passed at the state level is going to be paid for by additional takeaways from local government. That's the bottom line of that. So we haven't begun to see the real effects. I think that some of the things that you may be doing, even if they're mandated, are not as critical in a time frame of what do we have? Weeks to be able to deal with this problem before the larval effects of the current mosquito population have all grown and are gone. So I think the immediacy of it, the ability to be creative within your own departments and free up the person or persons to be able to do this. We know we want it done. If there's some additional funding that we need for that, obviously you're going to have supplies and things that we're going to need to fund. But computers, there's computers all around this organization. Vehicles, I think we can try and make sure that we use whatever vehicle is available from the motor pool. We've got to be thinking a little bit differently about how we do some of these services. I believe that's just at the core of what's required. The idea that we would just go out and start doing an assessment board and a review or a special tax, these are just ways of getting additional revenue out of the very people who are already paying everything we're doing. And no matter how we want to word it, a tax by some legal definition or not, it's saying that people are going to have to be paying more if we think that the only way to solve our problems is to set up another agency to do it. So I would really want to stress that we need to work within the resources we have. Put this right up there as you so perfectly presented it. It's a top priority, needs to be done now. And then I would just reorganize some of the other things you do to make sure that between your two departments, 66 and a half people, we could certainly find the two people or whatever that were being scheduled to do this. I think you can do that kind of manipulation for a very short amount of time is all we're looking for the maturity period. The other thing, though, I do want to bring up one other point. I'm very, very hesitant about the pesticide. These mosquito-eating fish, the ability to really do a good education, outreach to get rid of standing water, and probable the larvicide. But I think we've learned from through history that the pesticide approach, carte blanche over large areas, we don't know where we're going with that. And I don't believe that that's going to be something that the population is going to really take to. So I would love to put a lot more energy into these preventative things so that no carte blanche is ever given for a pesticide spraying over people.
Ms. Pinky?
Once again, maybe I misunderstood, but it's on, my understanding is people will be on board by mid-May or 1st of June at the latest.
Yeah, early June is our goal.
Early June, June not...
Oh, well, our goal is to go to personnel. If this passes today, our goal is to go to personnel tomorrow and say we want to recruit starting tomorrow.
Yeah. So,
and historically, the amount of time that it takes to recruit, 6 weeks is a short period of time. We would love to do it in 4 weeks or 3 weeks to get somebody on board. If it's expedited, it could be done before the 1st of June, certainly. It's not our goal is not July 1st by any means.
Okay, thank you. I thought I had misunderstood you. And then I have another question, either for probably Rich Little or Dr. Davis. Approximately, and I know let's assume that the virus hits this area, as severely as been predicted, the approximate number of people to be affected, and if there's any way of determining the approximate number of people who will die. Is there any way of...
The information
from the Colorado experience.
The information we have on is based on what CDC has determined. There's a range of 30 people to 150 that will acquire West Nile virus and not show basically any symptoms versus those that have clinical symptoms that may require treatment, hospitalization, or something like that. You have to understand we've only been dealing with this virus for about 4 years, so there's a lot more unknown factors than known factors. We can only base that on a very small sampling at this point. So the number is quite a big range right now.
Okay. No, the reason I asked that question, and I know my thought processes don't always follow anybody else's, but they're mine and I love them. As I'm listening to the discussion of the budget, which is of vital interest, obviously, and it's something that we really have to pay very close attention to, I was thinking about the arguments for not retrofitting Paso Robles. And I'm wondering whether the two people who died in Paso Robles were worth it, not retrofitting those buildings. And in my mind, this is an analogy. We're essentially not retrofitting the county to fight West Nile virus. And I'm wondering how much each one of those lives is going to cost. How much is it worth to us as a county to lose people? And frankly, at my age, I don't want to be one.
I can come up with a number, and that is Fort Collins area. The county around Fort Collins, Colorado, that one county had around 600 of the reported cases.
But no deaths.
I can't tell you the number of deaths from that area. I can only tell you the number of reported cases with approximately 37% hospitalization rate.
The point I want to make is, we're dealing with numbers, and we're dealing with physical health and safety at the same time. And we need to be very, very careful of the numbers. I'm not discounting that at all. It's a very important issue. But we're also dealing with health and safety. And And we mustn't lose sight of that health and safety issue as well.
I don't think we are. And as a statement I made as it started off in this, is the program, we need to do the program. Because we need the prevention, we need to move forward. And now let's go to the next step. And the next step is, how are we going to implement it? Are we going to go general fund and grab this money? Or are we going to look internally to the departments and look at our different priorities we have in the department? There's two different ways to fund it, or you're going to use a blend where we're going to change a little bit of priority in the departments, and we are going to fund some of it. And I think that's where our discussion needs to be based around. I don't think there's any discussion here on whether we should. I think that one's already taken care of.
Let me chime in here a second, because you know what I'm hearing is that I think the program is something that we're talking about implementing. What we're talking about is how to implement, and there's a very large discussion about the request that you've made and what we think you should do to try to find out how to do this. First of all, a question I have is, we get a report given to us up here, says 2003 year in surveillance. Who did that surveillance? Was that existing staff? No. It was not contracted out or anything else?
We hired that.
Yeah, last year your board provided us one-time funding of $44,000 to perform the surveillance. It was a seasonal program. It transacted two fiscal years, but it was basically March through October of last year. Mm-hmm. It was for seasonal temporary help. We hired one person, and that's what they did for 6 or 7 months.
What I'm looking at is that the additional staff that, if even needed, in order to get some of this work done, is what we would call a seasonal workers. I think, like some of the other board members, we're talking about supervisor position, we're talking about technician positions, and we're talking about special education specialists. You know that. That's the three largest personnel we've got, and then the others are seasonal workers. And I think there's a discussion that says that I think within the staff, because if you accumulate everything we've got going on, first of all, we're in this recycling thing, and we hired a half-time specialist to do the educational thing on that. And although it's not in your department, it's in another area. But, you know, we've had Yellow Star Thistle. We had a sharpshooter 2 years ago, which we put into the programs. We had a fire ant and the Africanized bee that were coming at us. And yet they have not yet materialized, and yet we have all this preparedness to do something with it. And I think that's where some of the board members here are saying that within those, we need to consolidate all those together and start looking at how we can put all these packages together instead of going out and putting on somebody else. And I guess that's where I'm coming from, is that, you know, like I said, that, you know, there's got to be a truck or two laying around out here someplace that's not getting used 100% of the time. And if you're only going to go 7 months out of the year, seasonal workers, that kind of stuff, I think we can find those things in computers and whatever else. The one piece of scientific equipment, the centrometer, and I know I said it wrong. I'm curious, like I said before, do we have that already in a health lab? Do we have those type of equipment that are not being fully utilized? And I think that's what the board's asking is, before we step out and make a commitment, we need to kind of look back at our own selves as to what we have. Let me go on further. Ms. Bernard?
Yes, I'd like to make just one comment, and then I'd like to make a motion, all right? Because I did check with Mr. Edge.
Yeah, let me get two other people in motion. Make a motion.
All right. Then I'll make my comment, and then I would like
to. I'll come back to you.
All right. When we talk about utilizing and prioritizing internally, I want to reiterate what Mike said in relation to the comment about doing something. No one is saying not doing anything. We're very convinced. You've done a very good job convincing us that this is a high priority. That's a given now, all right? We're not, you don't have to convince us any more of that. What I'm struggling with, and what I heard Mike struggling with, is how are we going to do it? What is the best way to do it as an organization? And, you know, I mentioned about the upcoming budget, and I just asked David, what are the projected layoffs in both of your departments? Now, you're talking about going out and hiring, but they're already doing the work on how they're going to balance it. And the projected layoffs, about 17 between the two of you. Now, how can you face people who are already working here and saying you're going to go out and go hire some more people right now and then turn around in 2 months and possibly be asking some of your own people to be laid off? What we're asking right now, what I strongly want to urge, is that we look and give David Edge the instruction, this is a high priority for us. We want you to look inside the organization and make it work and get the job done and get it done now. There needs to be a budget allotment for the incidental things that are particular to this, by all means. I don't hear anybody on the board saying they wouldn't fund that. But vehicles, computers, this stuff we have all around, special traps and whatnot, by all means. I would be totally, fully supportive of getting whatever material that you need to make that work. But that would be the essence of where I want to make my motion, is to acknowledge that you've done a great job in bringing this issue to our attention, to the public's attention, and that we need to find a way internally to get that job done. So that's it.
Mr. Edge.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Supervisor Pinard touched on a couple of numbers we're looking at going into next year's budget, and I think what your board is sampling, which you've had, and your predecessors have had the good fortune to not really have to sample in the past, is some of the difficult conversations that you have coming up over the next few months. We will bring to you as soon as we can a general discussion of where we think the budget is going, so you can get a sense and perhaps give us a sense of how you would like to prioritize. We'll do that before we get into the whole budget discussion process in June, and that's going to be a difficult conversation. In terms of this issue, Supervisor Pinard and Supervisor Ryan have touched upon the key realities in terms of expense, and that is your ongoing positions. In the greater scheme of things, it isn't that important to us whether you buy a pickup or don't buy a pickup. It's a one-time expense, and you are in a fortunate position of having some fair numbers of one-time monies that you can spend if you need to, and there are the centrifuges and stuff like that. If it's needed to make the program operate, then I wouldn't spend a lot of time arguing, is there a way you can filch a pickup from somebody else who perhaps isn't using it every day and maybe use that part of time? I'd rather say, okay, you know, here's the pickup, go use it. The key is, on an ongoing basis, what do you want to do? And if the direction of the board is, we want this program to happen, but we don't want to hire any additional staff to do it, then if you give us that direction, we will go away and figure out, within the totality of stuff that we do, how to make that happen. I mean, that's simply the reality of what our obligation as staff to your policy direction. Is that going to create some problems in other programs that we're doing? Absolutely. But the reality is, the citizens of this county have received a very high level of government service, whether some of them would say too high. It's whether it's a good or bad thing is open to debate, but the reality is we have over the years been able to create a lot of program service that for many of our colleagues fits into the nice to have category, and that's ending. And for everybody who is a constituency, for every service we've ever provided, and as you know, every time we create a service, there's an instant constituency that tells you that's a vital service. You're going to be in a position of saying, this is more vital than that. Just, you know, without giving you a litany from some of your colleagues, the most recent piece I read from Sacramento County Sheriff's Department, 450 employees, they are going to be eliminating 150 jobs out of 450 in the Sheriff's Department, which, like you, is the core service that every Board of Supervisors has as its highest priority, public safety. The DA's office is talking about reducing its net county cost by 78%. Those are real cuts.
Would you remind me that's in Sacramento?
That's in Sacramento County. And Sacramento isn't unique. That just happens to be the latest one that came across the wires in a newspaper report. I know you folk have seen, as I have, the layoffs in Monterey County and elsewhere. So the real issues are out there. This is not a huge
difficulty, but it's a very great difficulty for San Luis Obispo County because it's different.
I want to say one thing, too, before we go to Ms. Bianchi, and then we'll go to the motion. We're also looking at two levels of this situation. One is the 2003-2004 year operation, and then the continuing operation beyond that, which would be 2004-05, which is next year's budget. And so we need to react to that also. Ms. Bianchi, and then we'll go to Ms. Pinard.
I've heard today that you should review your departments and determine how you can fit this priority program into your departments. And I know that for all of you, all four of you, it's a priority program already. So my next question would be, what have you already done to do what has been suggested by my fellow board members? Because I'm sure you have all done, taken actions already. And I'd like to know what some of those are.
Well, I can start with a little bit, at least with environmental health. As part of the budget development process this year, we had to take a look at those programs that we already do and have already submitted recommendations for some staff reductions given the 2004-05 budget. Those things were what goes through my mind. I look at, number one, what is the public health significance of a program? That's sort of the first thing I look at. The next thing is the mandate, the legal mandate. And then, of course, as a final step, I look at the amount of general fund contribution that's already made to some of those programs. And that, and in that mix, decide what I'm going to offer to reduce, to be able to reduce staff, what services I'm going to offer up and discontinue doing. And,
I specifically meant this program.
Yeah, for this program. Well, it's the same exact process. I haven't sat down and said, okay, if we're going to do the mosquito abatement program within existing staff, what programs would I stop doing? But it's the exact same process I just went through for the budget purposes. And what I would have to do is sit down and decide which programs if I can be a little bit specific here for a moment, the concerns that come to my mind are things like our food facility inspections. Now, how many people are going to get foodborne illness in the next month or the next 6 months or a year and a half? It's somewhat of an unknown. But how many are we preventing by the work we do is if I reduce the number of inspections, I'm already down to a fairly minimal number, I believe, already. Same thing with our public swimming pool inspections. I'm already down to a fairly minimal number that we're doing. Some of that will mean if we reduce further, I'm probably going to have to reduce fees because they're going to be bringing in, they're going to be less service provided in those program areas, and many of them are revenue offset, or at least mostly revenue offset, and we'll have to just reduce the amount of fees so that we don't bring in more money than it costs us to provide that program. So there's some revenue offset, and without going through the specifics of every program, I've already gone through this exercise for the budget and have come up with some some cuts that have to do with response to complaints that we would discontinue doing. Many of those are things like solid waste complaints that they don't rise to a level of a public health concern, but they certainly are public nuisances. There were some other program areas that I picked parts of the program out. Rather than take away the whole program, I picked out parts and tried to have a minimal impact on the public health of the community and at the same time keep some of the revenue aspects of that program intact. I have, in my mind, I have run out of any easy choices.
the next choices will be the ones that are, their significant public health impact. An example, the vector control program as a whole, no revenue for that program. We respond to complaints, and we do a lot of that. If I had to give up something, I suppose, since there's no revenue associated with it, that would be a program that would go. But the public health impact of not responding to fleas and ticks and other kinds of vectors is there's a public health impact to that. I'm reluctant to move in that direction. I'm kind of down to that place where we will now have to choose between this public health issue and some other public health issue. That's the best explanation I can give you at this point. Without giving you dollar amounts, because I don't
do have one thing first. I promised that we go back to Peg for a motion, and then we'll get the motion on the floor and we'll discuss that. So what's your motion, Ms. Pinard?
All right. And I did just consult with David on some wording to be able to make sure that it was workable. My motion would read as follows. The mosquito abatement program needs to be elevated to a very high priority. And we direct the CEO to review the existing staffing and priorities and make this program work with no additional permanent staff added.
I'll second that, but I would ask.
Okay, so I have a motion and a second. Okay, then we'll go on. All right.
I would ask in that motion that it be brought back, and the goal is not having additional staff added. But I don't want to preclude it, because you may come into the point that, yeah, we're going to have a couple here because we can't make this one work. So don't preclude it from the discussion, but the goal is to work inside.
Interestingly enough, and it's probably semantics, but when you say no permanent staff, there is no permanent staff on this. You know, these are temporary positions.
No staff that receives.
Yeah, I understand it, but I'm just playing with the semantics on the word. Mr. Edge.
No additional staff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mrs. Pinard, do you agree with that change?
That's no problem. Then the wording would be make this program work with the goal of no additional permanent staff needed. Is that really clear?
Mr. Edge, you had your light on?
Yeah, thanks. Now I have to sound a little unfeeling, but it's kind of like deja vu all over again for me, with places that I've worked previously, having enjoyed the past 5 years of relatively good times in San Luis Obispo. We're back to where I'm used to coming. 1982, I was doing a budget in Kings County with the health department, and the director of nursing during the budget discussion asked me, how many babies have to die before you'll give me this money I'm asking for? And she actually asked me that 2 years in a row, and the first year as a fairly new analyst, I was pretty devastated. I went back to my boss, an old wise guy from Carolina, and essentially said, we do the best job that we can, and our job is to ensure that we are doing the most effective job we can with the money that the public is willing to provide to us to do that job. And if the bottom line, which is clearly just an emotional hook, is that a baby has to die, then that's not our responsibility, that's society's responsibility. And that's what it comes down to. And if, you know, when Kurt talks about the potential is if we do less inspections of restaurants, then a food poisoning outbreak may occur. That's true. But on the flip side, at some point you say, this is the number of restaurant inspections that we can afford. And you make that clear to the public. And then it's all of us as a public make our choices about how much money we're willing to put into the services that we are asking government to provide. And a board of supervisors, or staff for that matter, can't get into that discussion of what's going to happen if it's beyond your control. All you can do and is what your board's doing here. If you say, look, this is what we want you to do. Make this happen within this available revenue, because you don't have the option of going into a deficit spending. You have to balance the budget. If this is what you want to do and you believe this is a priority because of the health risk, you tell staff to make it happen, and we go figure out a way to make it happen. And there'll be consequences on the other side. One of the challenges we've had over the years is we've told the public, gosh, you know, if you don't give us this money,
there'll be terrible things happen, and then we've gone away and made sure that they don't really notice any of the terrible things, and the public says, see, you didn't need the money in the first place. The reality is, tell us how much money we've got, tell us what you want to do with it, and our job is to mix and match in the best way that we can, and what happens, happens.
One question I have real quick, and I'll go to Ms. Bianchi and Mr. Ryan. I'm sure embedded in your motion is talking about fiscal year 03-04 and fiscal year 04-05 and recommendations that are going to happen within that. And the other issue is whether or not to encourage them to go forward with the benefit assessment district. Or do we need separate issue on that?
Not in my motion.
No, but those are things that are on.
Motion.
Okay,
yeah,
that's separate motion. Okay. Ms. Bianchi and Mr. Ryan.
If we don't make a decision on this today, that is going to put it off for a while, right? And then that will put off the. Well, actually, never mind. I had this all written out in my head, and then. You know who goofed up my statement. However, I still haven't heard what Public Health and the Ag Commissioner's Office have done to cut their have done within their departments to make this program work. And I, you know, I don't see any of our staff as being exactly spendthrifts and wastrels. And one other thing, in response to, and actually, he is a good friend, David. Yeah, I voted against the bond issue for the state. And the reason I did was, unfortunately, we're going to have to hit a crisis situation before the funding in this state straightens up. So I'm well aware of emotional hooks. Very much aware of it. And I knew the devastation that would happen in this county if that bond issue didn't pass. But this is what we keep doing. You know, we keep asking our staff to do more and more and more with less and less and less. And as a result, the public doesn't know what a mess we're in. And so anyway, I'll stop pontificating and vote when the time comes.
The first issue comes down to we keep asking to do more, and the public keeps asking to do more, but doesn't want to pay for it.
That's right.
Mr. Ryan.
Well, you know, I believe the departments run pretty efficiently. But when you start looking at different things we're doing, just like Bob out there checking fruit flies or, you know, different types of fly traps, the people who are doing that could also be the people working the same route that's coming out and getting those water spots in that same area that they need to be doing. So there's a lot of mixed use type thing when we have a lot of people set with one task where we could actually have them do the same task because they're actually going through the same parts of the county and they could be doing a couple things at the time. And those things there are little things, but those are the little things that save us some of the money. And if we can save some of the money doing those type of doubling up on routes and that type of thing, I think that'll help. I think in the end result, we're probably going to have to give you some money to go along with this or a little bit, but we want you to look really hard inside before we go to the outside because this budget's going to get real hard. And, you know, is the tick the priority? Or, you know, you just sold us on the fact that West Nile virus, we believe you. That's the priority. You know, so you've made the sale. You know, now we got to weigh up, you know, where is that priority? You know, do we need to get out there and be on the front line on this one here? And we're saying, yeah, go back and take a look at it.
Let me go to Mr. Edge and then Mr. Lilly.
Now, just going to say, if it's the wish of the majority of the board, we don't have to delay starting to move on it to come back and tell us you want us to make it happen. We've got the drift. You don't want additional staff. And again, this is assuming this is the majority wish. We don't want new permanent staff. We'll start moving on something, and if we reach the point where we say, you know what, we can't move effectively without an additional permanent position, we'll come back at that point and talk to you about that. But I think that what I'm hearing from the board, and certainly I agree with, is start the program underway with your existing staff. You're going to have to invest some money in service and supplies. We recognize that. We're willing to do that. but start it going ASAP, and we'll work it out within a minimum budget as we go along. I think at the minimum, what you're looking at is for the balance of this fiscal year and through the mosquito season into the new fiscal year, we'll have a program that'll cover that period, and we can debate in the wider budget sense whether or not you want to add a higher level of funding for a more permanent program.
Okay, Mr. Lilly, and then we'll go back to the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to provide a little more clarity, Mike, on your question about prioritizing. Obviously, we feel this is important, or we wouldn't be sitting here. But as the Ag Commissioner, if we get, say, for example, a glassy-winged sharpshooter infestation and all of our grapes are quarantined, I'll have to put that first. I would be remiss in my duties instead of running the mosquito route. For example, this week we found out that our nurseries received plants infested with sudden oak death. So I have about 15 nurseries out there that are infested with sudden oak death, and I have to deal with that or my nurseries are quarantined. So I have responsibilities like that that I have to put as a priority, even over human health, because that's not my responsibility per se. On a normal week, if we don't have an emergency, I could probably piggyback those routes, like you said, and it would work out fine. But I just would want to make it clear that I have to deal with agricultural pest emergencies all the time, and those would need to take a priority for me over mosquitoes.
You know, we're going to have our public health department is going to do the same thing. If we have an outbreak of something, you know, they're going to pull all sorts of people going after that outbreak, and we may lighten up what we're doing on the West Nile virus while we're hitting this outbreak, and then we get back to it. You know, we understand those, but I think what we're after here is we're after not having that outbreak by doing the, you know, prevention out in front, and we're looking for the most effective and most dollar effective way to do it.
I'm not okay. Clear at this point. I hear the no permanent staff is what you want us to try and do, but I don't know what for materials.
Let me repeat the issue. The issue is that we want this program of elevated to a high priority, and we direct the CEO to work with the affected departments to move this program along within their respective departments with the goal of no additional permanent staff. It doesn't say without doing it. The thing is, what we want to do is what this board's been asking to do is let's dive into this thing and see how we can put some coordination in. And I'm reading into the motion this, but
no additional staff. We're not talking permanent because these are all limited deal. But just
it's a goal of no additional staff. But I know that this is, you know, and I think Mr. Ryan said is that we're not ignoring the fact that we're going to get to a point where some is going to have to be put into it. And I think Mr. Edge also stated that. We're looking at getting this program started as quickly as possible so that we get through this season. But the greater picture will be dealt with for the future budgeting and or the district will be dealt with it at a longer time period than trying to get through this year. And that's as I understand the motion. If there's no other lights on that, Mr. Thomas. Dr. Thomas?
Yeah, I don't understand what we're going to use for materials in the meantime. If we're trying to redirect.
Dr. Thomas, I think what was being said is that we would like to sit down with the CEO, start looking at what it is you really have to get. You know, as Mr. Edge said, we're not talking about the fact that we're looking at a personnel versus a truck because some of these are one-time expenditures, not. What we're looking at is what we can do with what we have existing without any further additional employees. And maybe that we will have to come back and look at some cost issues. But I think if I hear this board correctly, the cost issues are going to be more for the prevention side of the situation than it is for the capital improvements. And that's what I'm hearing. But we've delegated the CEO to iron this out with you people. And we've said to elevate this thing. And I heard the question called for. And the motion was made by Ms. Pinard and seconded by Mr. Ryan. With that, can we have a roll call vote?
Mrs. Pinard?
Aye.
Mr. Ryan?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
No.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye. Mr. Ed, and one final word.
I want to make it clear that my no vote was because I don't think it's enough.
Yeah.
A suggestion, Mr. Chairman, to help us move, we can handle ongoing, if we have some immediate services supplies, we can handle that within existing budget and then make adjustments down the road.
Yeah.
My proposal, if the board's interested, is give us today, authorize us $15,000 in round figures to purchase actually to fix the assets as outlined. That's excluding the vehicles. We'll come back on vehicles.
So moved.
Second.
Did you want that out of general fund, or can I take that out of medical services?
Well, just authorize us to purchase them. Then we can
find
come
it
back
other
and
than
deal.
General fund.
Well, no, it'll be general fund, but we can come back from contingency when we balance everything out.
I go again. Who made the motion on it?
I did.
Mr. Ryan, seconded by Ms. Pinard, then to authorize the CEO to find
$15,000.
And
for the fixed assets specified
the fixed in
them. You can ask Sherry, she has it.
Yeah, it's in their department, but I was going to push it medical services too. Roll call then.
Mr. Ryan?
Aye.
Mrs. Pinard?
Aye.
Mrs. Yankee?
Yes.
Mr. Ryan? Yeah. No?
No,
I'll go again.
No, you can't go again. Mrs.
Mr. Sajian?
Gotcha. Mr. Sajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Okay. So that should put that in, and you will report back to the board and let us know what we came up with and if there's any major changes.
You get something done right now.
Okay. At this time, then, the board will go into closed session. We have one amended item to the closed session, which is a conference with legal counsel on anticipated litigation. It's item number 9, Omega Chemical PRP Group Limited Partnership versus County San Luis. Is there anybody in the public who wishes to make comment on the closed session?
We were not going to discuss it.
No, we did that already. Seeing none. We did that. We'll go ahead and adjourn to closed session, and he says about 15, 20 minutes. So if you want to wait.
So that'll be about a half hour or so.
Board of Supervisors is now back in session. We concluded our closed session, and we have a report out of closed session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board met on the items that were listed on the agenda this morning, met for about 15 minutes, and took no final action, so no public report is required. Thank you.
Could we, before you adjourn, could we have the clerk pull the time on that for us, please?
Would you mind recording the time,
I
just so we can
hold
Mr. Lindholm accountable? With that, the board meeting stands adjourned.